You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Fawad Izadi. Fawad is a member of World Beyond War's Coordinating Committee. He is based in Iran. His research and teaching interests are interdisciplinary and focus on U.S.-Iranian relations and U.S. public diplomacy. His book, United States Public Diplomacy Towards Iran, discusses the U.S. communications efforts in Iran during the George W. Bush and Obama administrations. Izadi has published numerous studies in national and international academic journals and major handbooks, including Journal of Communication Inquiry, Journal of Arts Management, Law and Society, Rutledge Handbook of Public Diplomacy, and Edward Elgar Handbook of Cultural Security. Dr. Fawad Izadi is a faculty member at the Department of American Studies, Faculty of World Studies, University of Tehran, where he teaches MA and PhD courses in American Studies. Fawad Izadi, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
It's great to have you on, and thank you also for being a coordinating committee member for World Beyond War. What has the U.S. government's behavior been like toward Iran, and how has it changed, if at all, through the Bush years and the Obama years and now the Trump administration?
During the Obama administration, as you know, there was this nuclear agreement. Based on that agreement, Iranian government more or less stopped its nuclear program, and then the United States government was supposed to stop the sanctions.
Sorry, when you say nuclear program, that's a nuclear energy program, right?
That's what the Iranian government says, that this is a peaceful nuclear energy program. The U.S. government disagrees. They say that Iran has lots of oil, and they don't really need nuclear energy program. So they say the reason for the program is to eventually make a nuclear bomb. We have the International Atomic Energy Agency that has been monitoring Iran's nuclear program, and they have this terminology diversion. And what that means is that based on their inspections, no nuclear fossil material has been diverted to a military program based on what they have said. So they have inspected Iranian nuclear sites, and they have not said that Iran is making a nuclear weapon. In fact, if you look at the worldwide threat assessment of the U.S. intelligence community, for the last number of years, 10, 15 years, they also don't claim that Iran is making a nuclear weapon. They, the sentence they have is that they don't know if Iran will eventually have a nuclear weapon program. So what Iran has, basically, is a nuclear program. Iran says it's for peaceful purposes, and Iran has not moved towards making a nuclear bomb. This much we know. The problem the U.S. government has is that sometime in the future, since you have the technology, you may actually decide to make a nuclear weapon. And since we don't like your government that much, we don't want you to advanced in nuclear technology, because eventually you could use that for military purposes. And what Iran says is that, but we haven't done that yet, and we are a member of a non-proliferation treaty, NPT, and being a member of NPT allows us to have a peaceful nuclear program. So that's where the dispute is. Based on the nuclear agreement, JCPOA, Joint the stands for comprehensive plan of action or joint comprehensive plan of action. Iran basically said, okay, we are not making a nuclear bomb, but in order to get the sanctions off our back, we will more or less stop our nuclear program. So they used to enrich uranium at a 20% level. You need to do that at a 99% level if you want to make a nuclear bomb. But they were doing it at a 20% level. The Iranian government said, okay, well, don't go beyond 3.5%. They had about 10,000 kilograms of enriched uranium. They had stockpiled that for a number of years. And the Iranian government said, well, ship that out. So Iran doesn't have that anymore. Iran had about 19,000 centrifuges. And based on the agreement, two-thirds of those centrifuges were supposed to be put in a storage, and Iran did that. Iran had a nuclear site, a heavy water site, in city of Arak, middle of Iran, basically. Took about 20-some years to build that, and based on the agreement, they put concrete in the heart of the nuclear site. So Iran took a number of steps, basically implemented the agreement, and the International Atomic Energy Agency has been certifying that Iran has done that. Even when the Trump administration got out of the agreement last May, Iran continued to follow the agreement. But what happened with the Trump administration was that President Trump decided to get out of the agreement. And they did not really accuse Iran of violating the agreement because the International Atomic Energy Agency has been certifying, I think, 13 times already that Iran has been following the agreement. So the reason the Trump administration got out is because, not because Iran violated the agreement, but they said that Iran's behavior in other areas that U.S. has concerns has not changed. So, for example, they have a problem with Iran's regional policies. They have problems with Iran's military capabilities. And they have difficulties with the Iranian government. So the U.S. got out, and that's where we are now. It's about a year since the U.S. is out, and we don't expect the Trump administration to go back to the agreement. They have this maximum pressure campaign. This is the terminology that they use. And by maximum pressure, they talk about sanctions. So we have lots of difficulties with imports. Iran's currency, the riyal, has lost its value in the last number of months. It's about one-third of what it used to be worth about a year ago. So then the country's currency loses value, then whatever is imported is much more expensive. So anything that Iran buys from outside is basically 3-4 times more expensive than what it used to be. And even for products that are produced internally, some of the raw material comes from outside. So even internally built products also see a price hike. So we have, so the inflation is high, difficulties with the economy.
So Fawad Issadi, let me ask you a question. The line that Iran already has a lot of oil and therefore doesn't need nuclear energy is obviously being applied because of other concerns with the Iranian government. Otherwise, it occurs to me that Saudi Arabia also has a little bit of oil, and it seems to be perfectly fine for Saudi Arabia to develop nuclear energy, doesn't it?
Yeah, in fact, the Trump administration has given companies inside the United States to build nuclear sites, a number. I think there are going to be 16 sites, nuclear sites in Saudi Arabia. And actually, Saudi oil is more than what Iran has. And in fact, before 1979, before the revolution, we had the U.S. government basically doing the same thing to with regard to the Shah's government. They were saying that Iran, at that time, needed 20,000 megawatts of energy from a nuclear plant. So they were building, proposing for Iran to build a number of nuclear sites, the same thing they're actually doing with the Saudi government.
Yeah, the nuclear companies in the United States were advertising nuclear energy with big photos of the Shah, indicating that's nuclear right. energy was so great because the Shah likes it. Back in the 70s. What about labeling part of the Iranian military a terrorist organization? How does this recent development change the relationship?
You know, you have it World Beyond War. This is a great organization. This is actually going to result in a military confrontation between Iran and the United States, most likely, because Iranian forces, American forces, are at close proximity all over the Middle East. For example, you know, when U.S. Navy comes into the Persian Gulf, you know, the Gulf, especially at the Strait of Hormuz, is not that wide. And Iranian territorial waters, they basically touch the territorial waters of Iran, and then they go inside the Persian Gulf. And there is this, based on international law, law of seas, there is this radio communication between whatever ship is passing and the host country, the country that has the coast of that water. And so we don't know what's going to happen, because the security for Persian Gulf is done with IRGC, which is a big part of Iran's military, and now the U.S. has said that this is a terrorist organization. So is U.S. Navy going to communicate with this so-called terrorist organization? And if they don't, since this is actually Iran is a sovereign country, these are territorial waters, so it's going to be quite complicated, not only in the Persian Gulf, elsewhere, you know. Iran's troops are in Syria, U.S. troops, you know, in Syria, in Iraq, during the fight with ISIS. They used to coordinate with each other when they were going after ISIS forces. We have all these confrontations. Unfortunately, in the White House, we have people like John Bolton that have written about bombing Iran. And even Mike Pompeo, when he was a U.S. congressman, had asked for limited military operations against Iran. And these guys have powerful jobs. So if they want to implement the ideas they had before they got the job, then that's basically a military confrontation. And Iran is different with Afghanistan and Iraq. Iran's military is stronger. And so the sad news is that we are not moving beyond war. We are probably getting into one. And so people are quite worried in Iran that we are going to see another Middle Eastern war that is not necessary.
And this has been going on, as you know, for many years, the propaganda in the United States demonizing Iran. There was a survey of people in 65 countries several years ago asking what country is the biggest threat to peace in the world. And in many countries, the winner was the United States. But in the United States, it was Iran. People have been convinced that the Iranian government is out to get them. The Iranian people are out to get them. Iran is some sort of a threat to the United States. What do you say to such charges?
You know, Iran-U.S. relations have been quite difficult for many decades now, and it's not really what happened in 1979. The confrontation started in 1953, as you know, with the CIA coup. And this is many years before there was the current government in power. And the U.S. supported the Shah after the coup. You know, the Shah was a dictator, torturing people, funding resources. After the war, after Shah's overthrow and after the revolution, there was this chance of basically making up and sort of having normal relations. But at that time, U.S. government actually continued its support for the Shah when he was out of the country. And when they allowed the Shah inside the United States, some leaders in Iran thought they want to orchestrate another coup d'etat, and they sort of took over the U.S. embassy. And then after the embassy personnel were released, we had the start of the Iran-Iraq war. And during the war, the United States actually helped Saddam Hussein. The U.S. military used to provide satellite images of Iranian forces, and so they would give that to Saddam forces, and those pictures were used to attack Iranian forces with chemical weapons. U.S. military would take pictures again, and they would see the chemical weapons, whether they were successful in hitting their targets or not. So they had this military cooperation, economic cooperation. After the war, during the Clinton administration, there was this chance of improving relations again. But we had sanctions law, Iran Sanctions Act in 1996. The U.S. Congress was really not ready at that time to have any type of normal relations with Iran. And this flood of sanctions basically has continued. So I think throughout the last 40 years at this time, the government in Iran has, for some people in the government, at least, for example, the Rouhani government administration, have been interested in improving the relations with the United States. The idea behind the nuclear agreement was to basically resolve the nuclear program difficulty and then move to other issues of concern. So the idea of the Rouhani administration was to basically make a list of the things that the U.S. government is upset about and fix those problems and have a normal relations with the United States. But when the Trump administration came in, they got out of the nuclear agreement. So even the Rouhani government is not arguing for giving more concessions to the United States because they don't see any value in that. So I think, unfortunately, we are going to see many years of confrontation because of the experience that the nuclear agreement resulted in.
You know, Fawad, here in the United States, anti-war voices have been virtually shut out from the big U.S. media. You can't go on U.S. television and speak against war or war propaganda. But I, like most U.S. peace activists, I get phone calls almost every day from Iranian media wanting me to talk against war and against U.S. militarism. And I spoke with a friend recently who moved from Iran to the United States years ago, and she told me that nobody in Iran pays any attention to Iranian media. They believe it's all lies, and they believe Hollywood movies about the United States. So Iranian media is just a medium for speaking to people around the world who happen to tune into it. It's not a way to reach people in Iran. Is that accurate?
You know, Iran has a population of 80 million. It's a relatively big country. And there are different types of people in Iran. Same way you have different types of people in the United States. Not everybody in the United States is an anti-war activist.
Definitely not, unfortunately.
You have people in the United States that voted for President Trump. So you have this diversity of people in Iran, in the United States. The 1979 revolution was a popular revolution. It had no support from outside. It was opposing Western hegemony inside Iran, and it also was not an ally of the Soviet Union at that time. So Iran basically joined the non-alliance movement after the revolution. In the last 40 years, Iran, the government that came into power, has lost popularity with a significant portion of the population. And part of the difficulties they have is that they have not been able to deliver economically. And they have not been able to deliver economically because of corruption and also because of the difficulties they are getting from the United States, the sanctions they have been facing for many decades, and obviously there's mismanagement and the lack of proper management. So these issues have resulted in a segment of population not really supporting the government. There are elections in Iran. People dispute the way elections are orchestrated here. But we get about, you know, more than 50%, generally 60, 65%, sometimes 70% of the population, voting population, voting age population, that is participating in elections. That doesn't mean Iran's democracy is pure democracy or a democracy that doesn't have any difficulties. But what I can tell you is that Iranians want to resolve their problems internally. They don't want the U.S. government to interfere. The history of U.S. interference in Iranian affairs have been quite difficult and resulted in coups and support for dictators. And actually, when the U.S. government interferes, and, you know, whenever, say, there's a demonstration somewhere in Iran, you have the Secretary of State coming and making a statement or stating something, and that actually hurts the internal dialogue that any country needs to have to resolve problems that they have. Because one side is supported by the United States, and the other side thinks this movement is a foreign design movement, and that actually hurts the people who are voicing dissent. So we have we have internal problems, we have this external intervention, and things don't get properly taken care of. One thing I can tell you is that, you know, we have this UN Human Development Index. This is an index that the United Nations uses to see how people's lives have improved. For example, life expectancy, or
right,
the average number of years people are in school, or, you know, these sort of statistics. And actually, in the last 40 years, Iran has been doing quite well. And the reason is that the people who came into power after the 1979 revolution were from the poorer segments of society, from villages. And they actually helped their own hometowns, and that resulted in Iran's Human Development Index. Actually, it's number one in terms of growth in the world.
Yeah.
In the last 40 years.
Fawadi Zadi, we've got just 2 minutes left, and a dozen questions I had hoped to ask you. There was a delegation from the United States that you were kind enough to meet with in Tehran recently.
Yeah.
You're forming a chapter of World Beyond War. You're looking at possibly putting up billboards for peace. Can you talk about what you're able to do as a peace activist in Iran?
You know, I teach American Studies at the University of Tehran. And one of the things I try to do every day is to tell our students and also the general public about the United States. Because some people think that the U.S. is equal to whoever is sitting in the White House. And as you know and your audience know, there are many people in the United States that disagree with Trump's policies. The peace delegation that came in 3 months ago is a good example for that. One thing we need to make sure we avoid is, as I said earlier, military confrontation between Iran and the United States. And we need to educate both Iranian public opinion and U.S. public opinion about the realities and the sort of the disaster that wars create for human beings. And so that's part of what I've been trying to do for the last number of years. It's not that easy. We had, for example, difficulties with visas when this delegation was coming in, so that's a difficulty we have with the Iranian government. They should give visas to these delegations here. And then when these people go back, sometimes you have they have difficulties in the United States. So these are difficult tasks.
Well, it is something we will have to...
Anything.
It's something we'll have to continue to work on with further delegations. Fawadi Zadi is a scholar and educator in Tehran. Thank you very, very much, Fawad, for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a March Washington Post article about Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte said, quote, "As of December, more than 5,000 people have been slain because of Duterte's war on drugs," according to officials. That number, however, is significantly lower than the estimate given by human rights groups, which put the casualties at closer to 12,000 or even 20,000, close quote. Note the passivity of the phrase, "have been slain," and the choice to lead with an official death toll rather than human rights groups' less self-interested numbers. The 12,000 figure provides a link to a Human Rights Watch report that has never been the subject of a Washington Post news story. Among many things such reporting wouldn't lead you to suspect, 2 years ago, when the Philippine Senate tried to cut funding for the campaign of state and state-sanctioned violence, for which the toll of even 20,000 is almost certainly conservative, it was the United States that stepped in with the money to fill the shortfall. That's a direct line from your tax dollars to the leader who said, quote, "Hitler massacred 3 million Jews. There's 3 million drug addicts. There are. I'd be happy to slaughter them," close quote. Corporate media don't talk much about the Philippines, much less about the U.S. role and responsibility there. A recent piece from Foreign Policy in Focus, headlined, "It's Time to End U.S. Military Aid to the Philippines," filled some of that void. We'll hear from its author, Mellon ACLS Public Fellow Amy Chu, and hear also from two Filipino activist organizers, Ed Cubello and Mong Palatino. That's all coming up, and we're going to get straight to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. With his attacks on the poor and vulnerable, his disdain for international law, his assault on press freedom, and his personal meanness, Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte should not be completely unrecognizable to Americans. But U.S. media take little interest in Duterte, even as his war on drugs racks up a death toll of human beings in the tens of thousands, making the crisis seem to be something happening in a faraway land. But our next guest reminds us that the human rights crisis unfolding in the Philippines actually has quite a bit to do with U.S. actions and aid. Amy Chu is a Mellon ACLS Public Fellow. Her article, "It's Time to End U.S. Military Aid to the Philippines," appeared in Foreign Policy in Focus, among other outlets. She joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome to Counterspin, Amy Chu.
Thank you.
Well, U.S. news consumers may have heard about a crackdown or a war on drugs under Philippine President Duterte, a war that features extrajudicial killings, as the Washington Post rather dryly put it. For those who have only a vague sense that Duterte is taking a hard line toward drug dealers or trying to fight criminality, one AP report had it, how would you describe the scale and the nature of the killings, of the drug war, and what measures of accountability or transparency exist to even keep track of it all?
Yes, well, so as of December 2018, the Philippine Commission on Human Rights estimated that as many as 27,000 people have been killed due to Duterte's drug war, and police have officially claimed responsibility for 5,100 people who they have killed in anti-drug operations. The rest of the killings might be perpetrated by police as well as vigilantes. These are summary executions where police will be doing house-by-house operations, busting into people's houses and shooting people, or vigilantes will be riding in motorbikes and just killing people on the street. It's important to note that, you know, Duterte has been inciting them. In his campaign, he promised to kill 100,000 people in the first 6 months of office. Wow. And dumped them into Manila Bay. When he got into office, he told police that if you kill 1,000 people while doing your duty, I'll protect you. Police have really stepped up their drug operations since he's been in office. And there's actually been reports by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch that police are being paid rewards to kill people. This is an unofficial policy. It's not publicly acknowledged, but there are witnesses coming forward about this. And vigilantes who are perpetrating killings are also closely associated with the police. It's been documented that some have reported being hired by police. Witnesses have noticed collaboration.
Duterte was always clear that it was drug dealers and drug users whose bodies he was going to dump in Manila Bay, right? He wasn't really making a fine distinction there that people might be thinking.
Right. The people being killed include former users, people who no longer use drugs. People who are users and small petty dealers have been gone after. And most people are from poor communities. They're almost all low-income people, very low-income people. You know, just to share on a personal level, it's at the point where most people I know in Manila know someone who has been affected, whether it's an acquaintance, a family member, a friend. Just an example of some of the cases, there was a 17-year-old student named Ian de los Santos whose case became a source of national protest because for the first time, police were captured on CCTV cameras showing that they were dragging him and they later executed him. So the police claimed that he drew a gun on them, and that's the common story. And to justify all these killings, that the person fought back, they had a weapon. But because of the footage, people were able to press for these officers to be brought to trial, actually. So he was a young person who was killed, and there are many cases. There was a 14-year-old, Reynaldo Guzman, who was stabbed over 26 times and tortured. His body was found in a creek in 2017. I know someone whose both their parents were killed. So there's a very large dragnet in terms of who is being affected. And also a real climate of fear in these communities. People are afraid to come forward about it because they're afraid they could be next. There's a political element to some of these killings because some of the people killed have been local elected government officials and so forth.
And of course, beyond the fatalities, we also have lots of folks in prison, including pretrial detainees. Well, it's often isolated in U.S. press coverage. But of course, as you're just starting to say, the drug war in the Philippines comes in a broader context. And for that context, we were able to hear from two Filipino activist organizers. Mong Palatino is a former two-term Filipino congressperson representing the youth sector, and he's now Metro Manila chair of the group Bayan. He had this to say.
I think it is important to highlight and remind our friends in the U.S. that the human rights situation in the Philippines is worse than is depicted by media. So more than the drug war, Duterte has been waging an all-out war against suspected communist rebels. He declared martial law in Mindanao. He is jailing critics. He is filing trap-up cases against activists. And then the extrajudicial killings have targeted not just drug suspects, but also activists, human rights lawyers, environmentalists, and church leaders. So it is important to highlight that the deterioration of the human rights situation is linked to the rising resistance in the Philippines against the repressive government of Duterte.
We also got context from Ed Cubello, vice chair of the Philippines' May 1st movement. Here he's translated by Mong Palatino.
Particular sa pinat kalagayan ng mga manggagawang Pilipino na hindi pinapakita o pinapalabas sa mga mainstream media kung ano talaga yung kalagayan nila.
In particular to the situation of Filipino workers whose situation is not adequately reported by mainstream media in the Philippines.
Kaugnay nito yung usapin sa panawagan ng mga manggagawa para sa regular na hanap buhay at makatarungang sahod.
Related to this is the demand of workers for adequate jobs and living wages.
Katulad din ng atake na ginagawa ng rehimeng US Duterte.
Also, the continuing attack of the government against Filipino workers.
Dahil lumalala yung kalagayan ng mga manggagawa, dahil marami sa mga manggagawang Pilipino ay contractual.
Filipino workers are facing greater hardships because of contractualization.
Ang kontraktwal ng mga manggagawa ay hindi po pwedeng sumali sa union, bawal magtayo ng union, mababa ang sahod, at hindi pinapayagan na magkaroon ng maayos na kalagayan sa loob ng pabrika.
Filipino contractual workers cannot join unions, cannot form a unions, and their working conditions inside factories are not safe.
Kung mag tatayo naman ang mga union at pipilitin na ipagtanggol yung karapatan ng mga manggagawa para sa regular na hanap buhay ay tinatanggal ang mga manggagawa at inaakusahan ng mga terorista.
And if workers assert their rights, they are removed from their jobs or they are accused of supporting terrorist groups.
Kasunod nito yung atake ng gobyerno, kinukulong yung mga leader manggagawa, mga organisador, kaya napaka inam na malaman ito ng mamamayan ng dito sa US para naman na ma-inform yung pinakamaraming bilang kung ano yung tunay na kalagay ng mga manggagawang Pilipino.
Also, I'd like to highlight the jailing of union leaders, the filing of trap-up cases against union organizers, and I hope this will reach our friends in the US.
Amy Chu, another aspect of Duterte's repression of dissent, of workers, of judges, of indigenous leaders, it's also included attacks on the press, isn't that right?
Yes, there's a really large number of journalists who were killed in the first 2 years under Duterte's fall, which is the highest number of murdered journalists in the first 2 years of any office of any Philippine president. And one really prominent case, too, besides this outright killings, there's an Indian media outlet called Rappler, and the director of that outlet, Maria Ressa, just has had constant arrest warrants issued against her. I think she might be arrested right now. This is a form of harassment because they are one of the few outlets to cover the war on drugs as well as other issues from an Indian media perspective. But yes, what's important to understand is that the war on drugs is actually just one of several wars that is being waged in the Philippines right now. And there are other wars of repression that get a lot less coverage in the U.S. media, but they are also escalating. So one is this attack on human rights defenders and dissent from journalists to environmentalists to labor organizers to human rights defenders and lawyers, human rights lawyers. There has been an increase in killings. Secondly, there's also an ongoing war against terrorism in the Philippines, especially in the southernmost largest island called Mindanao. So this war on terrorism has been going on for quite a while. There's been ongoing civil wars in the Philippines. But under Duterte, he declared martial law in Mindanao in 2017, and there's been an escalation of bombings of indigenous communities, people being displaced. So that's going on as well. I also just wanted to say that in understanding the violence of the police and the war on drugs, it's important to put it in context of the relationship between the police and the military in the Philippines and also the role of armed forces. In the U.S., like historically, the police came from slave catchers. But in the Philippines, the police came out of counterinsurgency operations from the period of colonization and conquest under the Americans at the turn of the century. They started a military police system called the Philippine Constabulary. And to this day, the police and the military work very closely together on essentially military operations that are counterinsurgency operations. Basically, when the U.S. left the Philippines, or officially left it by giving it formal independence in 1946, it created a highly unequal society through colonization where there's very concentrated land ownership under this landlord class and also a very big landless peasantry. The economy in the Philippines has been geared towards exports, whether that's export agriculture. Today it's exporting migrant labor, call center services. The process of colonialism left this very big inequality, and constantly since 1946, there's been movements against that. There's been peasant insurgencies, there's been civil wars, there's been Muslim separatist movements, and the U.S. has always played a role in backing the elitist government and repressing these movements. Mm-hmm. And so today we have a situation where the manual of the armed forces is not about defending the Philippines from outside invaders. It's about continuing these wars against people within the Philippines. And it's really an ongoing legacy of this unfinished colonial project, especially when you look in Mindanao, like who is being targeted. It's these Moro, Muslim, and indigenous communities that historically have been the last footholds of resistance against Spanish and U.S. colonization. And now these indigenous lands, which are some of the last places to be opened up to multinational mining and logging corporations, people have been resisting against that, and that's part of why the communities are being targeted.
And in some ways, it seems as though the United States has never left. You've traced the history, but to be clear, what is the current role of the U.S. and particularly of U.S. military aid or aid to the Duterte government?
Military aid is absolutely critical in providing Duterte weapons, ammunition, surveillance technology, and bolstering his military modernization program. Duterte's regime is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid in Asia, and he has massively increased his own military spending, like double the salaries of police and military. His whole program is about increasing the power of the police and military even more. For example, just last year, U.S. military aid to the Philippines totaled at least $193.5 million, not including arms sales and donated equipment of unreported worth, about as much as pledged for this year. So this amount may not seem like that much compared to the U.S.'s own bloated military budget, but it's actually a very tremendous transfer of weapons and surveillance technology that's significant when it comes to propping up the Philippine Armed Forces capacity. And then meanwhile, there's also a U.S. troop presence in the Philippines. There's up to as many as 5,000 troops deployed in the Philippines at any one time, purportedly for war games, but also overseeing this counterterrorism campaign in the South. There's also unequal military agreements, longstanding ones like the Visiting Forces Agreement and the newer Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement that allow the U.S. access to Philippine military bases. Since we got kicked out in 1992, actually the people who went in the Philippines kicked out U.S. bases, but this is a way of getting around that. And then the Visiting Forces Agreement essentially makes it very hard to hold U.S. troops accountable when they perpetrate human rights violations, whether that's murder or sexual assault. So we give a significant amount of aid, and then there's actually a significant amount directly to the police. Of the figure I quote is, you know, we gave $33 million in aid to the Philippine police, plus $22 million to them in arms sales. And so, you know, we've been giving 5 million rounds of ammunition last year, 2,253 machine guns, besides other surveillance equipment and weapons. And when you look at the expenses, like, for example, a big expense in the war on terror is so-called aerial surveillance and reconnaissance technology. Mm-hmm. There has been an increase in bombings in Mindanao under Duterte. So hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced by militarization, and Duterte has dropped bombs on Philippine soil over 368,000 times.
So when we read those news reports, we should be connecting that directly to, you know, what our taxpayer dollars are funding. We asked Ed Cubello and Hmong Palatino what role the international community and folks in the U.S. could play in the work for social justice in the Philippines. Here's Ed Cubello.
Napakahalaga ng papel ng international community na malaman yung kalagayan ng manggagawang Pilipino at maipaliganap din sa pinakamaraming bilang ng mamamayan dito sa US.
The role of the international community is significant, especially here in the US, in adding pressure to the government about the protection of human rights in the Philippines.
Hindi sapat na maipalaganap lang yung kalagayan kung kakayanin ay maiparating din sa gobyerno ng Estados Unidos, sa mga politiko, sa Congress at Senado, na yung suporta nila sa rehimeng Duterte ay isang nagpapahirap sa mga manggagawa sa kanilang ginagawang atake sa mga manggagawa sa paikipagsabwatan sa mga kapitalista.
It's not just enough to inform people about the situation in the Philippines. We need to remind the government, legislators, and other institutions in the U.S. and other countries about the situation of workers in the Philippines and how workers are being repressed who are simply asserting their rights.
That was Ed Cubello, and now here's Hmong Palatino on the role of the international community in supporting Filipino human rights.
First, we'd like to thank our friends in the U.S. and other countries who have spoken out against the abuses in the Philippines and are standing with the Filipinos in asserting our rights. It is important to add pressure to the Philippine government by reminding the government to comply with international human rights standards. At the same time, here in the U.S., the Congress should review and stop giving military and police aid to the Philippines, which is being used to enable human rights abuses. We are also monitoring and supporting the process at the International Criminal Court, where cases have been filed against Duterte in relation to the drug war and other human rights abuses committed by state forces.
So this support is important in protecting the right of Filipinos in the struggle for human rights and democracy in our country.
Amy Chu, any final thoughts about what folks can do and also what reporters might perhaps do more or less of in coverage of the Philippines under Duterte and the U.S. responsibility there?
I think as reporters in the U.S., we should really cover the whole U.S. role in this whole spectrum of violence that's going on in the Philippines, not just the drug war. So, yes, thank you for doing this show and drawing attention to that. And I also think that as people in the U.S., like Mang Palatino and Cubello said, we have a special role to play in pressing our government to not support the Duterte regime and to end U.S. military aid for the Philippines, and also to make connections with movements on the Philippines, to build solidarity, to learn about the resistance movements there, and build bridges, and in connection to kind of the movements globally around these issues in terms of U.S. military presence and the impact it has. In Mindanao, one of the really concerning things that's happening is the use of paramilitaries against indigenous communities in a way that's really similar to U.S.-backed tactics in Central America that resulted in genocide of indigenous communities. So the Philippine military is similarly arming and training paramilitaries, and these are terrorizing local people. And one of their targets has actually been schools, because as part of efforts to organize against land-grabbing, indigenous communities have formed organizations starting educational institutions as something they really needed, because 90% of indigenous children do not have access to formal education. This service is neglected by the government, and they really also wanted to create education that's relevant to their communities, that's not paternalistic. So these schools have been bombed, like targeted. This community has gone through so much intensely, and this is the result of a deliberate campaign against those schools. The military cut off the water supply, and, you know, at the present moment, those schools are currently closed. So that is the situation that these communities are facing. There's dozens and dozens of schools in this similar situation. There were 2,000 students who couldn't attend classes because of being harassed by nearby military encampments in the past year. So that's the situation, and it's really disconcerting to read the reports of how we spend our money in these Department of Defense reports and also know people being affected.
One of many, many stories that reporters who are interested in what's really going on and the deeper context of what's happening in the Philippines, one of many stories, Mindanao, is that they could be digging into.
I'd also just like to lift up some of the resistance to the drug war, because I think it's in international media, like how terrible Duterte is about that, but we don't hear about the grassroots resistance, especially when there's such a vibrant movement in the Philippines in terms of mass-based organizations and low-income communities. So I just wanted to highlight a group called Kadamay, which is an organization of urban poor people throughout the Philippines, and their membership is the ground zero of the drug war, since the drug war really centers in Metro Manila and urban communities. So they were one of the first groups to come out against it publicly with protests and demonstrations as early as 2016, and they had a flyer about it, and I just wanted to share a little bit from it. Their flyer says, instead of using violence, we need to address the roots of the spread of illegal drugs in the whole world history. Drugs have not been eradicated through killings. Regular jobs and living wages, health services, education, and raising the quality of life are what is needed. Why is drug use widespread among the poor? The number of poor people in the country is increasing. Many are drawn to using illegal drugs to escape the hardships of life and even to be able to endure working longer hours despite sacrificing their bodies. The syndicates and corrupt officials also take advantage of the desperation of the poor. They can get underlings who are forced to work for them. Addiction is an illness that is very hard to treat if there is not adequate and prompt medical assistance. What's more, rehab is so expensive, and really still hardly any health centers are equipped to respond to this illness. And so they go on to say, we can't address this with killing, but with a movement of people to change society. This is the kind of organizing that's happening. In recent years, there's a group of families of people who have been killed in the drug war who have come together to also organize, called Rise Up for Life and Rights, and you can find these groups on Facebook if you want to support the work they're doing. So when we look at all this violence, we can't separate it from the U.S.'s imperial shadow. And when we look at the drug war, you know, we have to consider that in the Philippines, there are not social safety nets or significant ones, because they were never allowed to be developed because of the neo-colonial relationship between the Philippines and the U.S., there's never been a government budget for things, and there's widespread unemployment. And even presidency prior to Duterte, Benigno Aquino's regime had been celebrated as supposedly, you know, an anti-corruption government and unprecedented economic growth. Well, the reality is that poverty stayed the same. This was like a jobless economic growth that did not help the majority of people who still live on less than $2 a day. So there's widespread precarity. Most people with jobs work in the informal sector. So, I mean, most people who earn an income work in the informal sector. They don't have jobs. So despite what you hear about, like, the call for the industry in the Philippines or whatever, it's not reaching the majority of people. And so there's been a failure of neoliberal economic policies of the last decades, and that's played right into the hands of people's need to want some other kind of solution. And unfortunately, in the form of Duterte, you know, it's come in terms of authoritarianism.
We've been speaking with Amy Chu. Her article, It's Time to End U.S. Military Aid to the Philippines, can be found on Foreign Policy in Focus. That's FPIF.org. Thank you to Ed Cubello and to Mong Palatino. And thank you very much to you, Amy Chu.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's newsletter, Extra, or our Action Alert Network. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
As the second largest landmass on the planet, Canada is warming at twice the global average. the vast Canadian Arctic is heating 3 times average. The impacts spread around the world. Leading scientist Dr. Nathan Gillett explains a new climate change report from the Government of Canada. Then stay tuned as Alex and Canadian expert Paul Beckworth trade startling new science with explanations of strange winter storms in North America and new predictions for our global future. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. You may think global warming would be good for colder places like Canada. A new report from the Government of Canada warns against that myth. The country has already warmed about twice the world average and will continue to heat up faster than the rest of the planet during this century and beyond. Scientists project more flooding, more wildfires, extreme heat events, strange winters, and damage to the seas surrounding Canada's vast coastline. Here to explain is one of Canada's top climate scientists, Dr. Nathan Gillett, received his PhD in atmospheric physics from the University of Oxford. He is a coordinating lead author of the chapter on human influence on climate in the upcoming IPCC 6th Assessment Report. Nathan leads research into climate impacts for the Canadian government. From Victoria, British Columbia, Dr. Nathan Gillett, welcome to Radio EcoShock. We know the Arctic is wildly warmer than it was for our ancestors. Is Arctic heating the real reason Canada is warming about twice as fast as the global average? Or is populous southern Canada also heating up?
Well, both southern Canada and northern Canada are warming up more than the global average. The intensification of the warmest is biggest in the north, where there's a bigger amplification from melting ice and snow. But even the south of Canada is also warming faster than the global average.
Well, last year, as you know, here in the interior of British Columbia, we had damaging spring floods followed by province-wide wildfire emergency. What should people expect in Western Canada during the next decade or two due to increasing greenhouse gases?
The clearest signal is further warming, and that will be reflected in more heat waves, more hot extremes. And as concluded in the report, that will further contribute to an increase in wildfire risk. We can also expect to see an overall increase in rainfall. We can expect to see more extremes of rainfall as we go through the century. Here in British Columbia, there's already been a lot of glaciers have shown strong melting. We can expect that trend to continue. We can expect, because of melting ice and snow, the peak of river runoff is happening earlier in the spring, and we expect that trend to continue as well. So a number of impacts here in British Columbia.
What about the central provinces of Ontario and Quebec, where the majority of Canadians live? For example, what are the projections for extreme heat events there?
Well, as is the case throughout Canada, we expect an increase in the number of extreme heat events. The projections are similar for Ontario and Quebec. The hottest day of the year is projected to warm by about 6 degrees Celsius under a scenario with high emissions. So that's a business-as-usual scenario where we continue to emit greenhouse gases. Whereas if we're able to limit greenhouse gas emissions, to start reducing emissions, reduced to zero by the end of the century, then we would only expect about a 1.5 degrees Celsius increase in the hottest day of the year. So a big difference between business-as-usual and a scenario where we're able to reduce emissions.
And for centuries, people on the eastern maritime coast of Canada have been deeply involved with the sea and fisheries. What concerns you about the health of the seas around Canada as climate change ramps up beyond 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius?
Well, we're already seeing significant change in the ocean waters off Canada's coast, as described in this report. We're seeing ocean acidification. The waters are becoming more acidic, which is a problem for shellfish. We're seeing decreases in oxygen levels in the subsurface ocean, and we're also seeing a sea level rise that's largest in Atlantic Canada and also in the south of British Columbia. So there's a number of changes that are happening in the oceans around Canada that we expect to continue and intensify, especially above 1.5 or 2 degrees, and these will have impacts for a number of sectors, ecosystems in oceans.
And unlike the United States, the majority of Canadians do not really live near the coast. So are rising seas still an issue for the country?
I should have said at the beginning that my work is on the science of climate change more than the impacts of climate change. So the impacts of rising seas in Canada are a bit outside my area of expertise. Nonetheless, there are areas of Canada that are affected by sea level rise, or that will be affected by sea level rise. One area is the Fraser Delta here in British Columbia, also parts of Nova Scotia on the east coast are particularly susceptible, but absolutely sea level rise is an issue for Canada.
Nathan, what sort of climate science do you specialize in?
My area of specialty is in analysis of the causes of climate change, which we can do by comparing observations of climate change with climate model simulations to understand the causes of observed changes that we're seeing in different areas of the climate system.
And does Canada run full-blown climate models, as many other countries do?
Absolutely, yes. I work here in Victoria at Environment and Climate Change Canada's Canadian Centre for Climate Modelling and Analysis. We develop one of the world-leading climate models, which is used to support the IPCC assessments on climate change.
The rest of the world tends to think about Canada and cold winter in the same sentence. What has already changed in the Canadian winter, and where could it go for our grandchildren?
Well, we've already observed warming in Canada, which is largest in winter, about 3.3 degrees over the last 70 years, averaged over Canada. And looking to the future, the projected warming is largest in winter. So we expect the strongest warming in winter, and especially in the north. As well as a strong warming, we expect a shorter snow season, so a shorter period with snow on the ground. That's already been observed. We expect that trend to continue. And we expect a larger fraction of precipitation to fall as rain rather than as snow.
Why does the new report from Environment Canada suggest that the warming and the impacts are, quote, effectively irreversible?
The irreversibility of climate change is a conclusion that was brought out strongly in the last assessment report of the IPCC on climate change. Carbon dioxide that's emitted by humans into the atmosphere is only removed very slowly from the atmosphere and has a lifetime in the atmosphere of centuries to millennia. And the climate system response to that carbon dioxide is even slower. We've done simulations with our climate model of what happens if we stop emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And it turns out that the average global average temperature stays almost constant for centuries. Other work shows that extending to millennia. So past emissions have caused warming that is effectively irreversible on human timescales.
Many of my listeners in quite a few countries are worried that when the Canadian permafrost thaws in earnest, carbon dioxide, and especially methane, could overtake human emissions, heating the whole world even more. Has this thawing started, and what do your models show?
Increases in permafrost temperature have already been observed in Canada. This is discussed in this report. And as you say, feedbacks from melting permafrost are expected to increase future warming, though there's a lot of uncertainty in the size of the effect. The last assessment report of the IPCC assessed that emissions from melting permafrost would be between 50 and 250 gigatons, that's billions of tons of carbon, by 2100. So that's a significant amount of extra emissions. It's still much less than the direct human emissions, but it is a significant feedback on climate change. We're working to include permafrost feedbacks in our model. That's a topic that we're working on at the moment.
Previous studies, including from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, say precipitation will increase over Canada, even as the subtropics dry out on an epic scale. Nathan, talk to us about your expectations for precipitation here.
In general, precipitation is projected to increase over Canada in the annual mean. So the largest increase are projected in the north and in winter. Even in the annual average over Canada, there's a projected increase of about 25% under a high emission scenario. So that's a big, so that's a quarter more precipitation than we currently get by the end of the century. As for temperature, those increases are much more moderate under a low emission scenario where we're able to reduce our emissions. Extremes of precipitation, the most intense rainfall, are also expected to increase by a similar amount. So that could have impacts on flooding, for example, flooding in urban areas. That we were projecting an increased risk of flooding in urban areas going forward.
Even so, the new report, Canada in a Changing Climate, warns parts of the country could experience shortages of fresh water. Now, as an older Canadian growing up with so many lakes and rivers, that seems hard for me to believe. How could some Canadians face water shortages despite annual precipitation going up?
Well, the annual average precipitation is projected to go up, but in the south of Canada, especially under a high emission scenario, by the end of the century, there is a projected drying in summer. So overall, an increase in precipitation, but some regions in summer are projected to have decreases in precipitation. At the same time, water availability is more than just about precipitation, rainfall. In many rivers in Canada are fed by melting snow and ice. And as I mentioned already, as the climate warms, we're seeing glaciers melt, we're seeing earlier spring snow melt, and so the peak of flow is happening earlier, and the summer flow is projected to decrease, and that's driven by warming. So the summer flows in rivers in Canada in general is projected to decrease. So that could have implications for people that depend on those summer flows, for example, for irrigation or for other uses. So it's a complicated picture, but yes, some areas of Canada are expected to see decreases in water availability going forward.
When does Environment and Climate Change Canada project sea ice could disappear in the Arctic at the peak melt point, other than, say, a few bits around the Canadian Arctic archipelago? That is, at our current rate of emissions, when could we expect to have an open Arctic Ocean in late summer?
So most Canadian sea ice regions are projected to be sea ice free for at least part of the summer by 2050.
Middle of the century, not that far from where we are now, 30 years from now.
That's right.
Do we know for sure whether the great boreal forest that runs right across Canada's north is now a carbon sink or a carbon source?
So recent estimates based both on atmospheric carbon dioxide measurements and also estimates from models show that in general, the boreal area of North America is currently a sink of carbon dioxide. And that's happening for two main reasons. One is that as the carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, plants tend to absorb more carbon dioxide. And the second contributing reason is that as the climate warms, vegetation can move north, bushes and trees can move north, and as that additional vegetation grows, it can absorb additional carbon dioxide. So currently, the estimates are that the boreal region is a sink of carbon dioxide. That could change in the future depending on what happens to permafrost.
Canada is also a major food producer and exporter, but we can't really move crops like wheat too far north into the poor soils of the Canadian Shield. What are some climate concerns in your report for Canadian agriculture?
So this report is focused on physical changes in the physical climate system in Canada. There will be follow-up reports looking at impacts of climate change in Canada, which will look at these questions in more detail. That said, based on information from Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, some key concerns for agriculture in Canada are, well, so I guess one thing to say is that there will be some positive effects of climate change in terms of longer growing seasons. But the main challenges are expected to come from decreased water availability. As I mentioned, summer river flows projected to decrease, and also drying and more evaporation is projected in the south of Canada by the end of the century under high emissions. And another area of concern is additional heat stress on livestock from a warmer temperature, more heat waves.
What targets have to happen with global greenhouse emissions, like for all countries, for Canada to avoid the worst-case scenarios outlined in your new report?
The first thing to say is that future climate change depends on future emissions, and the amount of warming depends pretty closely on the total amount of greenhouse gases, total amount of carbon dioxide that is emitted. So any reduction in future emissions will contribute to reducing climate change. In terms of the scenarios that we looked at in this report, the scenario with decreasing emissions, which was approximately consistent with the Paris climate goal of limiting global warming to 2 degrees, has global emissions of greenhouse gases beginning to decline in the near future and being reduced to zero shortly after the middle of this century. So reaching that Paris goal of less than 2 degrees does require soon and rapid action to reduce global emissions of greenhouse gases.
And you're working on this. So when is the sixth assessment report from the IPCC due out? And what are Canadian scientists contributing to it?
That report is due to be published in 2021. So I'm working on the Working Group 1 report, which is concerned with the physical climate change. So I can give you information on that. There's eight Canadian authors, or eight people that, based in Canada, that are either authors or review editors of the report. So there's a pretty strong Canadian contribution to the preparation of this report.
And what is Working Group 1 looking at?
So Working Group 1 looks at changes in the physical climate system. So what climate change has been observed, what changes are expected in the future. Working Group 2 looks at the impacts of climate change, so how climate change is affecting ecosystems, human health, this kind of question. And then Working Group 3 looks at responses, possible responses to climate change. How can we mitigate climate change? How can we adapt to climate change?
Dr. Nathan Gillett is a senior research scientist with Environment and Climate Change Canada's Climate Change Research Division. We've been talking about a new report, Canada in a Changing Climate, Advancing Our Knowledge for Action. Find it on the web at changingclimate.ca. I'll put a link in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Nathan, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much.
Up next, Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith joins me to thrash through scary new science, the limits before extinction, ocean drivers of our lives, and why weather has gone rogue.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In the month of March 2019, the Arctic was at least 20 degrees hotter than it should be. Under that massive heat, sea ice is at a record low. Unprecedented Arctic warming is distorting weather in the whole northern hemisphere where the majority of humans live. Extreme weather has brought unhappiness, vast damage, and death. In this new climate age, the idea of progress seems to be replaced by constant efforts to recover. In the past 3 months, I brought you the science of climate change direct from specialists publishing top papers. To draw it together, we need a generalist with climate expertise. We need Paul Beckwith. Paul has two master's degrees. He often teaches climate science at the University of Ottawa, but his tireless effort to teach extends to the internet. On YouTube, Paul Beckwith is by far the biggest teacher of climate science to the world via YouTube. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
All right, so Radio EcoShock has listeners all over the world, as you know, so I try to keep a global perspective. But right now we need to talk about the second largest country in the world, Canada. After 10 years of being shut out with talking with the federal government scientists, that was during the Harper regime, today I finally talked with the climate scientist Nathan Gillett from Environment Canada, and he told us the rate of warming in Canada was double the world average. What is your reaction, Paul?
Well, Canada is a northern country, and we know that the further north you go, the quicker the warming is. So often people say that the Arctic is warming at double the rate, but that depends really on how you define the Arctic. As you go further and further north into the Arctic, the rate of warming is three times the global average, four times, five times, and so on. So I think the report that came out by Environment Canada about what's happening in Canada, yes, that overall I think the average was two times for Canada, but northern Canada is definitely three times or even quicker warming. This is a global pattern that we're seeing. Also, as you go up in elevation in mountains, the warming is also doubled or tripled over the global average, and people don't talk about that so much either.
And you know, many of our listeners worry that if Arctic ice disappears during the summer, that could change weather and climate for the world. I know you have been talking about that for years, literally. Is that worry legitimate?
Yes, the basic physics of how things heat up and how there's a phase change, like from a gas to a liquid to a solid, for example. So, you know, I've often said that the ice acts as a refrigerator. As long as there's ice in the Arctic, then the surface temperature while that ice is melting is about the freezing point. It's close to, zero or slightly below, depending on the amount of salt in the ice and so on. But yeah, so the ice keeps the Arctic cool. And, you know, when we lose the sea ice, then of course we've got this open ocean and it's going to warm tremendously fast compared to what happened when there was ice there. So we're seeing this. This is a big, huge concern for the globe because basically when there's no sea ice for the first time, and that could happen very, very soon. For, you know, some people have been talking about this year, but it's hard to predict any given year. But then the Arctic temperatures will literally skyrocket, and the jet streams will become completely unrecognizable. You know, we're seeing lots of problems with the jet streams being stuck. You know, for example, this big, huge trough over North America this last winter is one thing that is resulting from a stuck jet stream.
Well, Dr. Gillette is the coordinating author for some part of the upcoming sixth report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He helps run Canada's climate models. And with you in mind, Paul, I asked Gillette when the sea ice might be gone in summer, the so-called Blue Ocean event. He suggested that might come around the year 2050. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. And in fact, most sort of, I'll say in quotes, mainstream scientific views would say that number is closer to 2040 now. But if you look at the trends of the sea ice extent and the area and the volume, those trends are all sharply downwards. And those trends would seem to indicate that this event with no sea ice, the first blue ocean event, might happen within the next 4 or 5 years if you just follow the data. Of course, if there's some sort of feedbacks and some other things happening, you know, the climate system is always full of surprises, but the vast majority of these surprises are faster than expected, almost never slower than expected. So, you know, if expected by the most scientists is 2040, you know, faster than expected is going to be, you know, much, much sooner than that. And this last winter, the ice did not form that thickly. It was not strong. It's not thick. You know, in the spring, the last few months have been, we've had tremendously huge temperature anomalies. The Arctic's been super warm, and the ice is melting very, very quickly. In fact, it's about a month ahead of the normal melt, at least a month, maybe a month and a half ahead of the normal melt. If you look at the, you know, I highly recommend people just Google Arctic sea ice graphs and look at some of the data. It's updated every day. And you can see it looks like the ice is plunging off a cliff in terms of all of the measurements of how much there is.
We have an important new paper published April 8th by scientists in Alaska and Denmark. The title is Key Indicators of Arctic Climate Change, 1971 to 2017. Lead author Jason Bock said, quote, "The Arctic system is trending away from its 20th century state and into an unprecedented state, with implications not only within but beyond the Arctic." Have you looked at that paper, Paul?
Yes, it's an excellent paper. And what's nice is that a lot of these papers that are coming out now are in open journals, so they're not behind paywalls. So anybody can go, you know, and Google the title and find the original paper and have a look at it. And, you know, I highly recommend that people do that. I mean, and not worry too much about all of the scientific technical details, but look at the abstract, which basically is the gist of the paper, and look at some of the figures. And I, you know, when there's significant papers, I try to usually do a video and try to explain it in a sort of layman's terms as to what significance it has. So, yeah, I mean, the Arctic is completely changing, you know, very, very rapidly. It's going to a much, much warmer place. You know, a lot of the air from the Arctic is spilling out of the Arctic and going very, very far south, you know, which it's been doing and continuing to do over North America at the moment. So, you know, all this cold air that comes south means that the Arctic is getting much warmer. That cold air is being replaced by warm, humid air. So it's raining a lot more in the Arctic. And of course, that rain just cuts through the snow and it melts the permafrost and all the rest of it.
Well, what has the winter been like where you live in Ottawa, Canada?
We've had a very, very long winter. We had the first significant snowfall in early to mid-November, and we've had recent snowfalls, you know, in April, significant amounts of snows. And a bit south of us in the U.S., they had this so-called bomb cyclone, and, you know, many, many feet of snow. And that's also happening in April, another bomb cyclone with many, many feet of snow expected. And, of course, that's led to tremendous flooding in the Midwest. So, you know, we've had a very cold spring, and it's sort of continuing.
Yeah, I delayed my planting of garden here in British Columbia by 2 weeks because it was just too cold. The warmth hasn't come yet. And this brings up an interesting point because the public is so focused on global warming, it's pretty hard to convince people that a depressing cold winter could also be influenced by climate change. Do you think that this winter has had some climate drivers?
I think at this stage in the climate and weather situation, you know, rapid and abrupt changes, you can't really escape them now. I mean, this winter, the jet streams have had this very, very large trough, which has extended down over lots of North America, deep down into the U.S. And it's been a persistent pattern over North America this winter, and it's pretty much continuing into spring, although there are cases where it kind of rotates around and we get warmer weather for a bit, but then it comes back. So this is the sort of case that's happening with these bomb cyclones, for example. One of the things that I talked about in the past, you know, really thinking about, you know, what will happen when there's a blue ocean event, because, you know, people are focused on, okay, we're losing sea ice, we'll get a blue ocean, but then what next? Like, how long will it last? What will be the duration in subsequent years? You know, will we, you know, if we have an open ocean for a week or two, you know, or maybe the month of September in a few years, the first event, then what's happening within maybe a couple of years? It's open ocean for 2 or 3 months of the year for August, September, October, and within a few more years, then tack another month on either side. So open ocean, July, August, September, October, November. And then, of course, with the feedbacks, you can, you know, I think that we'll go to this situation within about a decade of the first blue ocean event. And then what's going to happen? Well, what happens with the jet streams? I mean, the jet streams are centered over the cold in the Arctic. Right? They're dependent on where all the cold is and also on the rotation of the Earth and things like that. And when there's sea ice and snow cover, then the center of cold is near the North Pole, you know, offset a bit towards Greenland because Greenland extends quite far south, you know, with the snow and ice. But then when there's no sea ice and there's much, much less snow cover on the land, the center of cold is clearly Greenland. And the center of Greenland is at 73 degrees north latitude, which is offset from the North Pole by 17 degrees. So does this mean that the jet streams will start rotating about the center of Greenland when there's no sea ice for long periods of time? And if so, this means that they will extend much further down into North America, bringing a lot of cold that used to be up in the Arctic into North America, right? So if they're centered in a different location, then we could be the last sort of bastion on the planet, the global warming hole, if you like, the area where there's lots of cold air coming down from the Arctic, for example. So, you know, are we starting to see this winter and in maybe the last few winters? It's an open question.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. You mentioned the flooding in the Midwest of the U.S. right in key food production areas, and I think that was a major event with long-lasting consequences. The mainstream media has forgotten about this story already. Tell us a little bit more about that, Paul.
Yes, so because the trough of the jet stream has extended far into the U.S. for most of this winter, it meant that there were lots of these storms coming through, especially at the transition point between the cold, dry air that's in the trough of the jet stream and then the warmer, humid air that's outside the trough. So we've had these streams of storms coming through, dumping huge amounts of precipitation and, you know, some snowfalls of 4 or 5 feet with these bomb cyclone type things. So we've had a very brutal, tough winter. And of course, then a lot of the snow, when it's melted, it's just the ground is being frozen still. So the water can't infiltrate into the ground. So it just runs on the surface. You know, we've had this huge widespread flooding. And the water has just been sitting there. And of course, there's lots of pollutants and things that are carried in the water from the cities and things. So the soil gets saturated. You can't plant, basically. I mean, what about the, like even now, the ground is just too soggy now, and the water, there's lots of water still lying there. So how can farmers plant? So this is really going to affect the food production in the U.S., But it's worse because of the tariffs and the trade battles between Trump and China, basically. A lot of the farmers, it wasn't profitable for them to sell all their grain, so they stored a lot more this last year than they would normally have stored. And, you know, a lot of these grain elevators that store the seeds, when they're flooded, the grain will then expand, and it's kind of exploded the big elevator, so they've collapsed. Of course, all that food, all that stored grain has been lost, and you can't plant, so it's just asking for trouble. I think there's a good chance of food price spike, you know, later on, end of summer, early fall, you know, when this trickles through the system. Yeah, it's not a good situation at all.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Okay. This is a perfect time for me to tell listeners about brand new science. It's still awaiting publication, and it announces a new phenomenon in the world, simultaneous heat waves across the planet. Professor Martha Vogel, a climate researcher at ETH Zurich, just presented the findings at a European Geosciences Union press conference in Vienna in the first week of April. And studying heat waves from 1958 to 2018, they discovered that only since 2010 has a modern planet Earth experienced multiple extreme heat waves at the same time. For example, extreme heat in the Mediterranean might also strike in the Arctic and Russia or North America at the same time. So transcontinental heat, that has terrible implications for food production and a lot more, just as you say, Paul.
Yes, and of course we can't forget the oceans. I mean, the oceans have been absorbing 93% or something of the heat on the planet, you know, for years and years and years. So when they release this heat, this is you know, a big factor in these global heat waves. I mean, mostly these global heat waves are considered, you know, in the past, they're mostly well within continents, right? They're not near coastlines. I mean, the water is always a moderating factor because it takes a lot more energy to heat up and cool down water because of its high thermal heat capacity. But now when the oceans on coastlines, for example, in the Middle East are 34, 35 degrees Celsius temperatures, then we get at least those temperatures on the coastlines with almost 100% humidity. You know, and this is a wet bulb temperature that where humans cannot work outside. They can't basically survive these conditions because the body's not able to sweat. I mean, we are trying to get more heat resistant and heat tolerant crops, for example, right? So science is trying to keep up, but the changes are so rapid, it's very difficult to do that. You know, most crops, as we know, thrive within a narrow tolerance range in terms of temperature. Assuming there's sufficient precipitation.
And a lot of that discussion of ocean heat is in a new report from the World Meteorological Organization, and you've done 2 new YouTube videos about that report. According to the WMO, in 2018, the heat content of the upper levels of the ocean were the highest ever recorded. Talk to us about that importance of ocean heat content and the current trends. If you can expand on that a bit, please.
Yes, of course, the distribution of heat on the planet is key. And, you know, we all know that the equator is warm and the poles are colder. And the heat moves from the equator to the poles via the air currents, you know, in the atmosphere and also in the ocean. You know, the ocean currents are moving much slower, of course, but the ability to hold heat is much greater in the oceans. But, you know, when you work out all the numbers, roughly 1/3 of the heat goes from the equator to the poles via oceans and currents, and 2/3 via the atmosphere. For example, you know, in the Arctic, because the Arctic is becoming a much darker place, it's absorbing more sunlight. It's heating because of this additional absorption, and therefore it lowers the temperature gradient to the equator. So there's less, you'd think that there'd be less flow of heat from the equator up to the Arctic and more going towards Antarctica, for example. So you have to think, try to think of the whole climate as a system of all of these interconnected parts. Now, the warming ocean, of course, is a huge problem because warmer water floats on top of colder water. So the ocean becomes more layered or more stratified, if you like. There's less water moving in the vertical direction. And we need water upwelling because the nutrients that are needed for plant growth, for phytoplankton growth, which is the base of the food chain in the ocean, they need these upwelling nutrients. So as the ocean becomes more stratified, you know, it has a huge impact on the ability of plankton to grow. And, and the ocean currents are, of course, changing because of the greatly warming Arctic. And, you know, the thermohaline circulation system is slowing down. So, you know, we're changing. The way heat is transferred on the planet seems to be completely changing, along with everything else, from rapid climate change.
People do get confused about the difference between ocean heat absorption, which is 93%, as you say, to greenhouse gas absorption, like carbon dioxide going into the sea, which is about 25% of our emissions. And I think we have to make that one clear. But look, Paul, if 93% of our excess heat is going into the ocean, that means only 7% is causing some of the disruption we are feeling now. And if the ocean takes less greenhouse gases, as scientists predict, then there will be more greenhouse gases remaining in our atmosphere. And if that's true, we have to cut off fossil fuels and other greenhouse sources pretty well immediately. And it seems strange to say, but our industrial culture may depend on ocean chemistry and ocean physics. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think so. You know, the oceans, you know, they cover over 70% of the surface area of the planet, right? We only live on the other 30%, you know, I've been saying we're in a climate emergency for years and we need to slash fossil fuel emissions, of course, but we also need to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And people are talking about that a lot more. And also, look at solar radiation management ways to cool the Arctic, for example, so that we don't lose all the sea ice and snow cover and expose Greenland to huge melting, you know, and a lot of these techniques, I think, can be done much more efficiently in the ocean. You know, the ocean used to be teeming with life, and that's no longer the case. So, you know, we should be changing our frame of reference to using terms like climate restoration. You know, how do we restore the climate so that it's more like the stable climate that we had before that we're quickly leaving? And, you know, the oceans can be a huge key to this, I think. You know, if we could restore teeming life in the ocean, think of all the carbon that would be encapsulated in this teeming life, right? Which is, you know, it would be carbon in the life as opposed to carbon in the atmosphere and in the oceans, making the oceans acidic. So, you know, stimulating phytoplankton growth, for example, would capture enormous amounts of carbon. We'd have life proliferating all the way up the food chain if we did that with phytoplankton.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. So, Paul, you say sea ice may be in a critical slowing down of a phase state before a collapse. Where do you get that theory?
Well, if you look at some of the papers that have been published, some of our knowledge on abrupt transitions or phase changes or state changes, often what you see is, like, it's really difficult. You know, we don't have a good way of predicting, you know, when exactly a tipping point will be reached, for example. But, we can look at situations where things have tipped, and often the frequency of the changes, you know, if something is trending, say, upwards linearly, there'll be variations and fluctuations, and these fluctuations in the sort of level can be very fast, and then if you take average everything out, you get a nice linear increase. Well, the frequency of which these fluctuations occur, that can often slow down. That often does slow down before the system sort of tips into a different state. If the frequency is slowing down, it means that the amplitude of the gyrations can increase. So there'll be more variability of these gyrations. So if you look at the sea ice decline, then you can see that there's some quite large variability in what the sea ice is doing from year to year. And, you know, I'm just wondering if that's sort of occurring because we're going to get this massive, you know, change all of a sudden. And I think it's very possible. Like, you know, getting back to the sea ice, I mean, I really encourage people to look at some of the graphs of what the sea ice is doing right now. I mean, you know, it's no surprise with an Arctic 20, 30 degrees Celsius warmer than normal in some places for months on end, that the sea ice is rapidly vanishing.
In a BBC article about that World Meteorological Report for 2018 that we talked about, Australian climate scientist and Professor Samantha Hepburn said, "We know that if the current trajectory for greenhouse gas concentrations continues, temperatures may increase by 3 to 5 degrees C compared to pre-industrial levels by the end of the century." Okay, so listeners, as you know, that is just utter disaster. Paul, do we know what level of CO2 in the atmosphere would result in 5 degrees C of warming?
We would need to accurately know the climate sensitivity. So for a doubling of CO2, it's believed that the climate sensitivity change would be anywhere from 1.5 to about 5 degrees Celsius. So the mid-level of that is about 3.5 degrees Celsius. Now, that's based relative to pre-industrial when the CO2 level was 280 parts per million. So doubling that would be 560 parts per million, and we're about 410 now, which is about 150 parts per million shy. At the moment, we're increasing about 3 parts per million per year, which would take us about 50 years. But then that doesn't consider, you know, it's not just the CO2 level that's important, it's the CO2 equivalent, if you like. So right now we're about 410 parts per million CO2, and the CO2 equivalent is about 490. So, you know, that's when you include things like methane and these other things. So if you just do the, you know, if you assume a linear increase, which it won't be, right, it's always faster than expected, but if you start somewhere and assume the rise per year, you can kind of figure out, you know, what year things would happen, but then that would assume that there's no massive tipping points, like, and we know that the Arctic sea ice is on its way out, you know, and that will represent a huge tipping point, an acceleration of warming in the Arctic, disruption of the jet streams, disruption of everything else. You know, it also assumes that there's no huge, methane burst, of course. Peter Wadhams has done papers about a 50 gigaton burst over, say, 5 gigatons a year over a decade, or a burst all at once. And that would cause a very, very rapid warming. You know, initially of the region where it came out, which would probably be up in the Arctic, and you know, how that would affect the planet. So it's really, you know, 5 degrees is just, it would be catastrophic, of course, for civilization. The IPCC, you know, they talk about an increase of 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 degrees, but they very rarely have talked about the implications. And look, we've had only, well, have we had a degree of warming? That's what most people will tell you. We've had 1 degree of warming, but then that's usually relative to the turn of the 1880 to 1910 sort of average or something. But if you bring it back to a baseline of 1750, which is when we first started talking about, you know, about the Paris, you know, those targets of 1.5 or 2 degrees should be, originally they were all referred to the 1750 baseline. And for some reason, that baseline keeps shifting closer to the present to make it seem like, the warming has been lower than it has actually been, right? So if you take our present situation relative to 1750, we're closer to 1.5 degrees already. So, you know, with that type of temperature rise, look at all of the worldwide disruption that we're seeing already, right? So, you know, we have to do everything we can to avoid getting anywhere near those numbers, 3 to 5 degrees Celsius.
Well, this brings up another really startling paper. I had a recent interview with the lead author, Tapio Schneider from NASA, and he told us that somewhere starting around 1,200 parts per million, we don't know for sure, but somewhere around there, stratocumulus clouds cannot form, and they are a major shade for the Earth. And that event, and it would be an event, adds another 8 to 14 degrees C of warming. So that's game over for humans and much of life. And I just know how we think. You know, humans will think that at 800 parts per million, for example, they still have another 400 parts per million margin before hitting that final brick wall. But that fails to realize, just as you say, that as the world warms, the contribution from natural processes increases as well, and most of that is irreversible. So do we know how much of a buffer we need to leave for things like permafrost thawing or dying rainforests?
I don't think there's any buffer for us. Like, we're undergoing these enormous changes around the planet, and it seems to be taking forever for people to recognize that, you know, we're being affected every day. You know, every day, every week around the planet, there's these really crazy, you know, extreme weather events because the climate has shifted. And it's just, you know, when will the pain be large enough for a large enough number of people to actually have governments and actually say, okay, we're in an emergency situation, acknowledge the reality of how bad the situation is and how quickly we're going, you know, it's worsening, and then take strong action at, you know, these three-legged barstool things that I've been talking about. I mean, there is a lot more talk now about carbon dioxide removal, you know, being absolutely required to bring down CO2 levels to try to stabilize the climate. You know, I think a real turning point in human understanding and view on climate change, I guess, might be when there's no Arctic sea ice left. Like this massive flooding in the U.S., I mean, you know, people are still trying to attribute these events to sort of just weather and something natural, and, you know, we can't do anything about weather, and, you know, it's nothing to do with climate change. like it's unbelievable how entrenched these views are with major political parties.
You did a YouTube video on a major blockbuster study published by NPNAS October 14, 2018, titled Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. And I interviewed the lead author, Will Steffen, here on Radio EcoShock. And they, in that study, expected the average global temperature to settle between 4 and 5 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial, even if the Paris Climate Accords are carried out, which is not happening. And sea levels can go up 10 to 60 meters, which is 33 to 197 feet, they said. Doesn't that mean that even our best climate plan takes us right to disaster, not just for this civilization, but towards mass extinction? And I mean, that's our plan?
Yeah, it's very difficult to understand how we actually got ourselves into this horrible situation. And, you know, but I mean, we always, you know, as humans, we always try to figure out a way to get out of a you know, a terrible situation, right? But we're certainly not, we're doing nowhere near enough, and there's still all of this denialism. And, you know, as far as that study goes with the clouds, I mean, the effect of clouds on the climate is one of the most difficult things for scientists to model and understand. I mean, for one thing, the altitude of the clouds has a huge impact. So these so that just means layered cumulus clouds. These are low-level clouds, basically, and they block a lot of the incoming sunlight, so they keep the surface of the Earth cooler. So that study where, you know, at 1,200 parts per million, if these clouds can no longer form, then all that sunlight can hit the Earth. It won't be shielded out. You know, meanwhile, the high-level clouds, the cirrus clouds, the highest wispy, thin, those clouds that are very high up, those clouds actually trap some of the infrared radiation, so they actually have a warming effect. When there's more of these high-altitude clouds, the planet will actually be warmer. So one of the ideas to have more radiation escape the Earth would be to, if there was a way to thin these clouds. But this study is talking about the good clouds being not able to form, and I don't think it really mentions too much. It wasn't looking at really what was going on with the higher clouds, if anything. We're in a terrible situation. We're in an emergency situation. But I think we are coming closer to people recognizing, you know, around the planet that, yes, we're in a terrible situation. But the problem is that the power structures, they have far too much influence and control on actions at high levels. And, you know, they're not acting in the interest of the public at all, you know, with continuing to subsidize fossil fuels and denying climate change and, making very select few number of people extremely wealthy that are in the industries that are the root cause of the emissions into the atmosphere of greenhouse gases.
Yeah, you were, I think, sort of a leader in calling for a planetary emergency, and now there are groups calling for that. For example, climatemobilization.org is calling for that. Do you see that call for immediate large-scale action growing? And, for example, were there school strikes where you live in Ottawa or in nearby Quebec?
Yes. There's groups called Extinction Rebellion, which are growing in leaps and bounds across the planet, lots of different places. There's the students, right? Students, you know, starting with the...
With Greta Thunberg.
With Greta Thunberg, yes, in Sweden, and her, she did it by herself for many months. She would just, sit outside Parliament on Fridays and not go to school, strike come. I don't know, maybe it started all week, and then she thought she moved it just to Fridays. She's a bright kid, and she could probably learn everything and not go to classes at all, but... and then that was involved 1.4 million people around the world recently, and there was a big march in Ottawa onto Parliament Hill, and I believe it was March 15th or March 16th or something. So I joined, and there was a good sized number of people. It was, I estimate about 1,000 people in Ottawa were at this event. And this was a worldwide thing, and it's also continuing. So, there's more and more people recognizing that we're in a lot of trouble with climate change, but there's still this inertia of the old system. There hasn't been a tipping point in human action, I guess, to carry us where we need to be. I mean, when we see government getting rid of their... like even the Canadian government, with Trudeau and their climate, the carbon taxes, right? I mean, they bring in the carbon. It's sort of deja vu to the Green Plan years ago, which cost Stephen Dion his job, right? the green shift or whatever, they called it the Green Plan. Like, he brought in the carbon price, and then they lost the election, and they said, well, it was because we brought in the carbon price. No, it was the price of oil was $140 a barrel, and the liberals were unpopular anyway then, and, but as long as these governments are funding fossil fuels to the tune of billions and trillions of dollars, it sort of makes a mockery of everything else they say and try to do. Like, they're just not being honest about the problem.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, international listeners may not know that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, when he was faced with the fact that private enterprise, the oil companies, and gas companies didn't want to build an extra pipeline to Vancouver due to public protests. They didn't want all the tankers on the coast, for one thing, didn't want the climate change for another. He just decided, the government will buy this pipeline project for, I think it was $4 billion, and the government will build it so that we can get that dirty tar sands oil out of Alberta and into the world market so we can burn even more carbon. So don't talk to me about a green plan and how green you are when you're doing that kind of stuff. And it's happening all over the world. We're seeing what Trump's doing. I don't even want to go there. It's terrible. So I'd like to focus a little bit more as we wrap up here on you, Paul Beckwith. You get a lot of visitors to your blog at paulbeckwith.net. You currently have over 15,000 subscribers for your 538 videos on YouTube. And as of April 11th, your channel had 3,257,000 views, so millions of views for this work. How did you end up becoming an electronic climate science teacher to the world?
I don't know. I mean, you don't really plan a lot of these things. I think what happened is, at university, I started teaching a climatology course, a second-year climatology course, and just loved it. So I taught it again, and then I started teaching other geography courses, like geographical approaches to environmental issues. And then I designed and taught an oceanography course. And I just taught more and more courses and then started to create these, did a blog for a while and then started to do these videos. And the videos started to get more and more viewers. And it just kind of took off from there. I mean, I was able to reach a lot more people from videos, and it's a different way of teaching as opposed to being a lecturer in a classroom to, a big class and to doing it in front of a camera and sending it out to the world. So, yeah, it's just sort of carried from there, and it's all been sort of driven, I guess, by, a passion to get information out to people on, what was really happening with climate change. I found that the scientific community, really failed miserably in getting the information from their papers. We're a world of specialists, I guess, each doing our own specialized thing. And it seemed to me that there was a huge void of people who could take all of the research and all of, sort of form a big picture of, where things are going and what's happening, what happened in the past, where are we now, what can we expect in the future? So, momentum just sort of built up, and I started doing it more and more. And, I must say, it's not the easiest thing to do to be facing climate change, rapid and abrupt climate change, right? It can be a very, it's a very sort of negative thing. I mean, we're trashing our planet, and a lot of people just want to turn away and pretend it's not happening until there's direct effects on people. And now there's more and more direct effects on people. It's difficult to always be the bearer of bad news to people. So, I've often struggled with, am I making an impact? Do I really want to continue this? Do I want to save it back? Do I want to maybe focus a bit more on trying to look at so-called solutions? Do I even think that there are any possible solutions? Because there's a lot of doom and gloom right out there. There's a lot of people that go from, climate change isn't a problem, to, we can't do anything. It's finished. It's over. Just enjoy your life sort of thing, right? And, it's not all or nothing, right? I mean, I think we absolutely have to try to do things to ensure that we can, survive on this planet. And, we don't know what the final result will ever be. But certainly the political situation has gone from bad to terrible, depending on what country you're in. And, even in Canada, we can look at the U.S. and say, I'm glad we don't live in the U.S. We don't have a climate denier leading government who's chopping all of the organizations of science that want to study the problem and so on. But we have a guy who says, climate's really serious and that, and he goes and he buys pipelines and stuff. So it's a very difficult, area to be in. And, I don't have all the answers. I don't have, all the solutions. But, I like to talk about, I just talk about what I see happening.
Well, it's the same for me. In radio, I find it hard, sometimes depressing. Other times I just find amazing science. I love to learn how the world works, and I know you do too. But maybe that's why we need Shackleton the Cat in your videos, to just touch on something a little bit safe before we head into those graphs of doom that you present. We're going to have to call it for this week with our guest and climate scientist Paul H. Beckwith, and I will load up my blog with links to all the papers and videos that we've talked about in this program. You can find that in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Meantime, surf over to paulbeckwith.net to get the latest climate science explained, and look for his channel on YouTube. It's easy to find. Please support Paul in his unique work to spread the word over the electronic world. It was great to talk with you again, Paul.
Thank you, Alex.
Be sure to visit my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. I post links to all the science papers, popular articles, and videos you want to follow up. And thank you for listening. Let's meet again next week.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
We're speaking with Tamara Nassar, our colleague at the Electronic Intifada, speaking about home demolitions, the brutal continuing policies of ethnic cleansing by Israel against Palestinians. Tamara, as you mentioned at the beginning, you're also covering a lot of the power dynamics and the close relationship building between Israeli leaders and leaders of Gulf states. Walk us through a little bit about a little bit of your most recent reporting on this, and you know, tell us why it's important to factor in these kinds of relationships between leaders in the Gulf and Israel. And why and how it kind of fits into this context of building Israel's projects of Zionism and violence in the region.
Yes, there's definitely been a huge rise in normalization between Arab countries, especially in the Gulf, and with Israel. This, I suppose, the most recent blatant form of it was when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu went to Oman to visit, to meet with Sultan Qaboos. Oman and Israel have no formal diplomatic relations. In fact, Israel has no formal diplomatic relations with any of these Gulf states.
So this is, for listeners, this is Oman, the country, not Amman, the city. This is the country next to Yemen.
Yes. Jordan and Israel do have diplomatic relations. So when Netanyahu visited Oman, this was the most, you know, blatant form of overt normalization with a country with no formal diplomatic relations. We saw last week in the Warsaw conference, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also met with the Omani foreign minister, Yusuf bin Alawi. The meeting was supposed to be in secret. Yusuf bin Alawi actually arrived to Netanyahu's hotel in the Polish capital from like the side door, but Israeli journalist Barak Ravid caught him on camera sneaking into the building, and then the official meeting between Netanyahu and bin Alawi was actually videotaped, and in the video, you know, Netanyahu thanks bin Alawi for meeting with him again. And he says that he feels at liberty to speak on behalf of not only Israelis, but many people in the Middle East to thank Oman for this, for their warming up to Israel. But this, I mean, this also has been, it's very disgusting, but it's also been happening with other Gulf states. Of course, this is being pushed by Saudi Arabia with the mutual enmity towards Iran at the core. In October, while there was a blitz of normalization with Israel, there was an Israeli judo team that went to the UAE to participate under the promise by the Emirates that they would allow the Israeli flag to be displayed and the Israeli anthem to be played should the Israeli team win any medals, which they did, and the Israeli anthem was played in Abu Dhabi. And racist Israeli cultural minister Miri Regev was there, and she even cried while the Hatikva was playing in Abu Dhabi. Same thing in Qatar. The Israeli gymnastics team went to Qatar and participated in a tournament there. And these are just, you know, sparse events that show just a larger effort by these Gulf states to basically race to Israel's heart out of mutual animosity and warmongering against Iran. Mm-hmm. So,
And this is the same Miri Regev who once apologized to cancer sufferers for comparing them to black people.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about normalization and the concept of normalization in Arab countries? Because many listeners may not be familiar with this, and maybe talk a little bit about how Israel is regarded in that way by people in the Gulf states, as opposed to, in the Arab world in general, as opposed to the Arab dictators and the leaders.
Definitely. I mean, there was a moment in the Warsaw Conference. The Yemeni foreign minister was seated right next to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's microphone malfunctioned, the Yemeni foreign minister lended him his microphone. And former settler guard Jason Greenblatt went to Twitter and of course, celebrated this moment and said, this is great, because when that happened, Netanyahu said, oh, this is like cooperation between Yemen and Israel. So Netanyahu was clearly exploiting like every single anything that these Gulf leaders are giving him to kind of normalize relations. But on Sunday, which this was amazing, a lot of people in Yemen were posting pictures of enormous crowds of Yemenis going out into the streets and saying, we refuse Yemeni normalization with Israel. We refuse any Arab normalization with Israel, and we do not agree to this. So the public in most of these countries are completely opposed, not only to, you know, diplomatic relations with Israel, but in many cases, and even acknowledging that Israel as a country in the region, as long as Palestinians are oppressed. Mm. So the fact that a lot of these leaders are speaking to Netanyahu and other Israeli officials, whether in secret or not, really angers the public, because it's coming at the expense of Palestinians, and most of them know it. So,
Israel has peace agreements with the Egyptian dictator and with the Jordanian king, but aside from that, Israel has no formal diplomatic relations with any Arab country. I think that's right. Am I right? I'm not forgetting anyone there.
No, you're right.
And can you talk a little bit about, but despite that, there are, as you alluded to earlier, there has been for many years secretive contacts between Israel and Gulf dictators in particular. Can you talk a little bit about the history of that?
Definitely. I mean, Barak Ravid, who I mentioned earlier, Israeli journalist with Israel's Channel 10 and 13, has been documenting that history recently in a series of normalization in history pieces. And most of these relationships span two decades or more, which is really crazy. And I mean, this has been, I've been covering events of, secret meetings between Israeli officials in those Gulf states or with Gulf leaders. One of the recent events of an Israeli leader visiting one of those Gulf states was Israeli opposition leader Avi Gabay, who visited the UAE in December and met with senior Israeli officials. There's also been, I mean, Qatar, which is a very, people seem to think that it's actually one of the biggest normalizers with Israel. Ali Abu Na'ma and I wrote a report in the summer about how Qatar funded the Zionist Organization of America. And
yeah,
other...
I find this quite staggering, really. I mean, I would have thought the Qataris would have been smart enough, like from their point of view, to have funded, I don't know, like J Street or something, and then they could have at least said, oh, you know, these are, you know, liberal and pro-peace or whatever, whatever kind of propaganda like that. But instead they chose the Zionist Organization of America, the most, you know, right-wing...
Extremist. Yeah.
Zionist organization, Mort Klein, openly racist, you know. I mean, like, why? what do you make of that? I mean, I still don't quite get that.
Yeah, I mean, ever since Qatar faced the regional isolation and blockade by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, it has really tried to escape that by running to Washington's heart, and the closest route to Washington's heart is through Israel. So leading up to that event, Qatar was inviting so many Zionist figures, Zionist American figures, to Qatar to go on these state-sponsored trips where they would meet with Qatari officials and go on these tours. And I mean, some of the influential figures that they invited included the Zionist Organization of America's president, Morton Klein, as well as Zionist propagandist lunatic Alan Dershowitz, who visited Qatar twice that we know of, including a trip.
I think we can say now as well, alleged pedophile Alan Dershowitz.
Yes, yes. One of the worst people on the planet. Yeah. And he visited Qatar twice, including one trip where he went to Northwestern University in Qatar, and he gave a lecture, and students actually walked out from the lecture and filmed themselves walking out of the lecture in protest of his presence in Qatar. And, you know, after the first time, he came back to the U.S. and published an article in The Hill singing of Qatar's praises and saying, you know, why is Saudi Arabia blockading Qatar, and Qatar is the Israel of the Middle East. That's one of the lines from his piece. I mean, Qatar's ruler Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani has been absolutely shameless in his all-out giving literal funds to the Zionist Organization of America and this other organization called Our Soldiers Speak, which gets Israeli soldiers to go on speaking tours in the U.S. to spread their propaganda. So,
I think it's, I'm kind of speechless.
Yeah, I mean, those trips also included Mike Huckabee and the conservative radio host John Batchelor. And a lot of them came back. I mean, Mike Huckabee tweeted about his trip and tweeted some pictures and said that Qatar was a beautiful country. John Batchelor.
I think we could say that these people were bought off with Qatari lobby money, you know, in the same way that many American politicians are bought off with Israeli lobby money, you know. And we're not going to be called Islamophobic for saying that.
No, the Qatari government literally gave $1.45 million for Lexington Strategies, which is the firm that was lobbying on its behalf in the U.S. So, and this was all disclosed in a FARA document. So it's not making this up.
Tamara, before we close out, what are some stories that you're currently watching right now? And what's coming up for you on the Electronic Intifada?
Well, I'm honestly closely watching Barak Ravid's reports. They contain a lot of staggering information about normalization that happened in the past years that was mostly either not confirmed or not covered before. One detail that really shocked me was that, well, it's hard to say that I was shocked, but that's really, it's always sickening. It's rarely shocking. Was that the Saudi government supported Israel during its assault, during its war on Lebanon in 2006, and urged them to strike Hezbollah with all their might, and were actually disappointed with Israel's with the results of the war, the report also revealed that former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met with Saudi prince. With a Saudi prince in Amman with King Abdullah. So these kinds of meetings have been happening. That was in 2006, right after the Israel's war in Lebanon. So these details are very important to understand, because there is so much that happens that is completely covert and that is not really not information that anyone knows about. And it tells a lot about how Israel thinks of its foreign policy to people, you know, towards in the region, which is why Israel's whole like shtick with being surrounded by enemies just always baffles me, because you know all these people are more of your friends than they're ever going to protect the Palestinians.
Yeah.
You actually have many many friends in the region.
I think that when they're talking about being surrounded by enemies, what they actually mean is the people, the Arab people themselves, because it's quite telling that they have to make peace agreements with dictatorships, essentially. And I think that and it just shows like the what you were talking about, how Israel is not accepted by people in the region because of the way it was founded and the war crimes that were necessary to found Israel. And I think that what the point you made about the Saudis supporting Israeli war crimes in Lebanon in 2006 is illustrative of how Israel and Gulf dictatorships, Arab dictatorships, are like actually natural partners. Like the Saudis are like the Saudi monarchs are, you know, they're similarly sectarian, racist, anti-democratic forces, which are meddling. Both countries are meddling in other countries around the world. You know, so those regimes deserve each other.
They do, and and that's why they're trying to rush out of the whole Palestinian the resolution of the Palestinian question, because what's really at the heart of all of these normalization, all of these moves towards normalization are this mutual interest in war against Iran. So, and one of the biggest obstacles that these regimes are facing are their own people, because their own people are not on the side of this kind of normalization. They care about Palestinian rights. They care about the occupation. They want an end to Israel's apartheid. They want Palestinians to get their rights of return and to be able to return to their homes, and for the occupation to be lifted, and for everyone to get equal rights in Israel. But I believe personally that before that happens, it's going to be very hard to create a boogeyman out of Iran for the general Arab public, as much as because Israel has made an enemy of itself for these people for decades.
And in fact, when he was in Warsaw last week, there was a direct translation of a comment that he made that said, "From here, I'm going to a meeting with 60 foreign ministers and envoys of countries from around the world against Iran. What is important about this meeting, and it is not in secret because there are many of those, is that this is an open meeting with representatives of leading Arab countries that are sitting down together with Israel in order to advance the common interest of combating Iran." Could also be translated to war with Iran. And apparently those comments, you know, that people said, oh, it's taken out of context. Was it really? I mean, that was the actual translation of what he said.
Yeah, I think his office was trying to save him from his own comments and said that it was mistranslated from Hebrew. and what he was actually trying to say, that, you know, he was calling on everyone to combat Iranian influence, but really it's just like a Freudian slip, and this is what they're going for. So it's terrifying.
Yeah, it is. Well, thank you, Tamara Nassar, for being with us on episode 3 of the new revamped Electronic Intifada podcast. And we're going to link to all the stories we've been talking about on the blog post that accompanies this podcast, of course. Thank you for all of your work. It's always a pleasure and an honor to work with you every day.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Thank you.
I feel the same way, and I'm very honored to have been on the EI podcast. So thank you very much for having me.
I thought that was a fantastic interview. It's always nice to hear from one of our colleagues. Tamara's just doing incredible work, and we all really appreciate her contributions editorially, and also the work, the really incredible work that she's doing in the reporting world.
Yeah, I think I always read Tamara's stories about Gulf normalization, and especially about Qatar, the stuff about Qatar, and as it relates to the Al Jazeera documentary that was suppressed.
Right.
And we didn't even have time to go into that. But
that's right. I mean, Mort Klein, she talked about Mort Klein at the ZOA, who actually went to Qatar to try and get the Al Jazeera documentary fully censored.
Yeah,
was
successful in terms of it not being broadcast on Al Jazeera's TV channel, although we leaked it, so ha-ha. Tough luck. But I'm sure we'll have Tamara on again. She's like a natural broadcaster.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another great episode. Thank you so much, Asa. Have a great week, and we'll be back next time.
Yeah.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Yousef Mounir, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, who assesses the results of the April 9th Israeli election, where voters embraced Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and permanent occupation of the Palestinian people. Joe Emmersberger, a Canadian-based independent journalist, who explains why he believes that U.S. charges being brought against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange pose a serious threat to press freedom. Anne Nelson, a Salvadoran man seeking asylum in the U.S., who talks about the reasons he fled his home country with his wife and daughter after receiving death threats from drug cartels in El Salvador. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A surprise assault on Tripoli, Libya, by a militia commanded by a former loyalist to Muammar Gaddafi, scuttled a United Nations peace initiative in the war-weary North African nation. At the time of the attack, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres was in Libya mediating talks with the hope that it would lead to a peace summit meeting. Militia leader Khalifa Haftar, commander of the so-called Libyan National Army based in Benghazi, is supported by France, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. On the other side, the UN, European Union, and the United States back the interim government of National Accord in Tripoli. Now militias on both sides are fighting in the outskirts of Tripoli and at the international airport, raising fears that this battle could trigger a full-scale civil war. Haftar, who lived in exile in the U.S. for 20 years under CIA protection, has long dismissed diplomacy and called for military force to impose unity in oil-rich Libya. While the UN and Western powers have called for a ceasefire in Tripoli, the internationally recognized government says it will agree to a ceasefire only if Haftar's troops withdraw from the capital and return back east. Villages and towns in the highlands of Guatemala have emptied out as farmers hurt by climate change and dire poverty have migrated to the United States. These villages, largely populated by indigenous people, depended on only a few basic crops, including maize, to feed their families. But according to the New Yorker magazine, with rising temperatures and extreme weather linked to climate change, Guatemalans from the highlands are fleeing in increasing numbers. The malnutrition rate, which hovers around 65% in the highlands, is among the highest in the Western Hemisphere. In 2014, a group of agronomists and scientists working on an initiative called Climate, Nature, and Communities of Guatemala produced a report that cautioned lawmakers about the region's susceptibility to a new threat. The highlands, they wrote, was the most vulnerable area in the country to climate change. The Obama administration pledged roughly $750 million to an aid package for Central American nations known as the Alliance for Prosperity, which aimed to address mounting poverty, political corruption, and cycles of crime and violence. However, very little of that money dealt with issues of environmental sustainability. In July 2017, the Trump administration ended funding for the Climate, Nature, and Communities program, and on April 12th, Trump announced that he was cutting all aid to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala because the three countries, quote, haven't done a thing for us. Monsanto, maker of the herbicide Roundup, is being held accountable for its corporate misconduct as two juries in California ruled the active chemical in Roundup causes cancer. A federal jury in California unanimously decided that the weed killer Roundup was a substantial factor in causing the lymphoma of 70-year-old Edwin Hardman, who had used Roundup on his property for many years, awarding him $80 million in damages. Earlier in August 2018, another jury concluded that groundskeeper Dwayne Lee Johnson developed cancer due to his exposure to Roundup and ordered Monsanto to pay Johnson nearly $300 million in damages. Monsanto, now owned by Bayer, faces over 11,000 lawsuits claiming the agent in Roundup, called glyphosate, caused cancer in people who use their product. Bayer continues to maintain that Roundup, with annual sales over $9 billion, is safe. In response to the lawsuits, however, retail outlets are reconsidering sale of the herbicide. Warehouse membership store Costco recently pulled Roundup from its shelves. Monsanto's internal communications, unsealed in Hardman's trial, showed that the company had an aggressive PR strategy that involved attacking negative research and ghostwriting and pushing favorable studies. Internal documents also shined a harsh light on Monsanto's cozy relationship with U.S. regulators, prompting the jury in Dwayne Johnson's case to declare that the corporation had acted with malice and was responsible for his cancer. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After winning a close race against his nearest opponent, former Israel Defense Force Chief Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White Party, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is heading towards a record fifth term in office. After the April 9th election, Netanyahu and his supporters were confident that they'll be able to put together a coalition of their Likud party with other right-wing and ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties in the Israeli Knesset or parliament. This despite the fact that the Israeli prime minister faces likely indictments in three corruption and bribery cases brought against him. During the campaign, Netanyahu pledged to annex Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank if re-elected, a move in direct defiance of international law and United Nations resolutions. Hanan Ashrawi, a prominent member of the executive committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization, declared that the election results confirm the persistence of what she called Israel's racism and extremism. Your reporter spoke with Youssef Moner, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Here he discusses the outcome of Israel's election, Netanyahu's campaign pledge to annex Jewish settlements in the West Bank, and the role the Trump administration played in emboldening Netanyahu's commitment to a permanent Israeli occupation of the Palestinian people.
The main opposition parties to Netanyahu, and you're right, he is likely to form a right-wing religious coalition, very similar to the previous coalition. The opposition was not really opposing Netanyahu's policies towards the Palestinians. In fact, they didn't campaign in any way on opposing his policies towards the Palestinians. If anything, they came out with a very similar line on these issues. The head of the opposition party was himself a former Israeli military chief of staff, launched his campaign by bragging about how many Palestinians he had killed, and his position towards the question of peace was, in his own words, they will continue to build and strengthen the settlement blocks. They will never divide Jerusalem. They will forever hold on to the Golan Heights, and they will hold on to the Jordan Valley. Of course, this is the vast majority of the West Bank. And they would retain security control throughout the entirety of the territory. This is just a fancy way of saying that they will never end the occupation. This is the opposition to Netanyahu, not Netanyahu himself, right? So they are really speaking one language when it comes to this issue. And so as far as the Palestinian people are concerned, as far as Palestinian rights are concerned, this election was really a competition between one Trump-like figure and another when it comes to the rights of Palestinians.
During the campaign, Netanyahu pledged to annex Jewish settlements in the Palestinian West Bank if reelected, extending full Israeli sovereignty over settlements widely considered illegal under international law. I wondered if you would dig down a little bit into what we may see now from Netanyahu now that he's likely to form the next coalition government.
Right. In some ways, this is not particularly new, but in some ways it is. It's not really new in that the position of Netanyahu, the position of his party, for a very long time has consistently been the complete rejection of Palestinian sovereignty in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They've always opposed that. They continue to oppose it. They continue to support the building of settlements, the colonization of Palestinian territory, and so on. He said something very similar on the eve of the last election when he declared definitively there will never be a Palestinian state on my watch. This idea of retaining control forever in Palestinian territory is not really new. What is different now, though, is the language that they're using to describe this control. And they're talking about annexation. And, for all intents and purposes, the territory in the West Bank has in many ways already been annexed by Israel, particularly Area C. What has not happened is that the Israelis have not afforded the Palestinians there the rights that they would afford to Israeli citizens in other Israeli territory, particularly the right to vote in elections. Millions of Palestinians were denied a right to vote in this election because they are not Israeli citizens, despite the fact that they're living under the control of the Israeli military. But, you know, now we're starting to hear this talk about annexation, and obviously, you know, Netanyahu feels emboldened by this election victory. He's going to be relying very much on right-wing religious nationalists for whom, you know, the West Bank is ideologically important territory, who, of course, want to retain control over it forever. And also, very importantly, he has been emboldened by an administration in the White House, which has really given him almost every item on his wish list, from recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, something the Trump administration did that no previous administration was willing to do, to recognizing Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, which was very recent, of course, during the lead up to this election, and also something that no previous administration was willing to do. So, you know, Netanyahu knows now that he has a friend in the White House in President Trump, and he may be able to get the Trump administration to recognize once again a step that he would take in annexing territory in the West Bank, part of it or all of it, in the hopes of creating an irreversible reality that future administrations would be reluctant or would not be able to reverse. He sees a window of opportunity to reach for, you know, his greatest colonialist dreams, and he may very well seek to take that opportunity in the weeks and months to come.
That was Yusuf Munir, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Find more analysis and commentary on the Israeli election and Netanyahu's victory by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was arrested inside Ecuador's London embassy on April 11th after that nation's president, Lenin Moreno, withdrew asylum protection. Assange took refuge in the diplomatic compound in 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden over a sexual assault case that has since been dropped. Assange now faces extradition to the U.S., where the Justice Department recently unsealed an indictment of Assange, filed in March 2018. If Britain extradites Assange to the U.S., he'll face one count of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion related to incriminating Pentagon documents on Washington's human rights abuses in the Iraq War, published by WikiLeaks, which were received from then-U.S. Army Private Chelsea Manning in 2010. Assange's lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, said they would be fighting extradition to the U.S. and warned that it would set a dangerous precedent where any journalist could face U.S. charges for publishing truthful information about the United States. Your reporter spoke with Joe Emmersberger, an independent Canadian-based journalist who talks about the arrest of Julian Assange and the serious threat to press freedom.
Chelsea Manning, who's in jail again because she's refusing to testify to a grand jury, she's already spent 7 years in jail because she was the Defense Department analyst who leaked files to WikiLeaks. And she spent 7 years in jail. I mean, it's just to think about that. She exposed war crimes. That's why she did this. She was horrified by what was going on in Iraq. There was that infamous collateral murder video that that WikiLeaks released that came from Manning, where it showed the U.S. troops in Iraq gunning down civilians and laughing about it. One of the troops involved got kicked out of the army because he subsequently requested medical psychiatric attention for the trauma of treating children who were seriously wounded in that attack. So it was just a horrific thing that they exposed. And so that alone, just based on that alone, Manning herself should never spend a day in jail. And she spent 7 years. I mean, she exposed horrific crimes. So whatever breach of contract or confidentiality she perpetrated, it's totally justified by what she was trying to expose. And that extends, so if she shouldn't spend any time in jail, obviously Assange, who merely was acting as a publisher, trying to get the information out. If you read the indictment, it basically, most of it is just accusing him of doing journalism, of working with a source. But there's one specific thing the media has latched onto where it says that Assange, in the indictment, item 7 of the indictment, says he there was an agreement, alleged agreement between him and Manning to try to crack a password so that Manning could download the files in a way that would help her avoid detection. So he was trying to help her download the files in a way where she wouldn't get caught and, you know, suffer horrific, suffer terrible consequences. And you could tell from the indictment from item 10 that, you know, because they say they used the word would have, you know, that it would have allowed Manning to log on and would have made it more difficult for investigators to find out who she was. So basically, they're in the indictment itself, the so-called agreement, whatever it was, if it existed between Assange and Manning, it didn't work. So it's not even what resulted in the files being downloaded. So, I mean, it's just flimsy all over the place. You know, the law should protect somebody who did what Manning did. The same way, you know, the law should protect, you know, if I use violence for no reason, obviously I should be held accountable. But if I use violence to protect myself or to protect somebody else, then the law should protect me. The law should not throw the book at me. And that's basically the approach people should take to Manning and to Assange, obviously.
Joe, what are the essential issues that the British judiciary will have to deal with in the coming extradition hearing as to whether or not Assange will be extradited to the United States to face these charges?
When you mentioned the extradition hearing, it's very worrying because the UK government is not going to face a lot of pressure from a lot of people who should be sticking up for Assange, will be making a very half-hearted defense. It shows that Theresa May's government, the UK, will not face a lot of pressure if she decides to just ship him off to the United States. Now, the leader of the opposition in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn, he came out with a very strong statement initially, anyway, defending Assange very forcefully, pointing to the collateral murder video in his tweet he sent out and saying that he should not be punished for releasing this information. So that was very encouraging. But within his own party, there's such reactionary people who would just be happy to see Assange shipped away or put up a very hypocritical, a half-hearted defense, which, again, just makes it easy for him to be shipped to the United States.
Joe, I wonder if you would explain to our audience how these charges pending in the United States against Assange could jeopardize freedom of the press if Assange is extradited to the U.S. and is found guilty and imprisoned. How does this affect the work of investigative journalists here in this country?
Yeah. In a recent article I wrote for FAIR, I noted that even the former general counsel of the New York Times, he said that this whole idea of a conspiracy charge is probably one of the most dangerous things, threats to the free press that the Trump administration could possibly do. Because if it's such a vague thing, if a journalist is contacting a source confidentially, if the journalist is trying to encourage him to say, hey, what can you get for me? If the journalist is dealing with somebody who they know is not supposed to be doing this, right, is not supposed to be getting the information, even if the journalist isn't actually doing it, right, actually breaking into the computer itself, but just trying to help or work with the source or, suggest, give advice about how to avoid detection or anything like that, it'll be the burden of proof will be on the journalist to prove that they haven't done something wrong. This will impact the journalists who actually want to do something. It won't impact the journalists who just want to curry favor with the powerful, which is unfortunately most corporate journalists, in my opinion. But it will affect those who actually try to expose wrongdoing and publish things that the powerful people really do not want published. Because that's when the journalism really becomes important and valuable, is when you're actually publishing something, most valuable anyway, when you're actually publishing something that they want hidden. That's what Assange did to a huge extent, and that's why they're going after him.
That was Joe Emmersberger, an independent Canadian-based journalist. Find links to his recent articles on the arrest of Julian Assange and threats to press freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
thousands of people from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and southern Mexico keep heading to the southern U.S. border with their children, hoping to gain asylum in the U.S. Most are fleeing from violence, poverty, and climate change exacerbated drought. There are many specific requirements that must be met to qualify for asylum in the U.S. These standards had included fleeing from gang violence or domestic violence, but the Trump administration has been steadily restricting the reasons a person can claim asylum and says it will no longer accept such claims in granting asylum status. An immigration attorney explained that while 90% or more of migrants pass their credible fear hearing at the border, very few actually win asylum and will be deported back to their home countries. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus recently spent 9 days on both sides of the border in Tucson, Arizona, and Nogales, Sonora, Mexico, interviewing both migrants hoping to get into the U.S. and those who had passed a credible fear hearing and were on their way to reside with sponsors. In a tiny room in Mexico, very near the Nogales border crossing, Tuhus interviewed a Salvadoran man named Nelson. Because he'd previously worked in the U.S. and Canada, he spoke English, but said he returned to his country in 2011, hoping things would be better. But he found little had changed in El Salvador, so he fled with his wife and daughter. Here he talks about the threats he and his family received from drug cartels in Salvador that drove him to seek asylum in the U.S.
As soon as we heard that if you came to here to the border and ask for a refugee status too, you can get help. So that's how we do it. We came here and asked for help. I mean, we got proof of what is happening right now with my family, right? So I know there is so many people that came and it's just a lie or I don't know. We start like a process here. Every people who came here receive a number. All right. Yeah. So, for example, I'm number 1,147.
And when did you get here to this room?
Yesterday and in the afternoon.
And do you think you'll be leaving in another day or something? Or?
Maybe in another day, probably by tomorrow.
And then you're going to go to the border. You're going to get in the immigration process in the U.S. You have to convince U.S. officials that you have a credible fear.
Yes,
like they say, credible fear.
That's the first thing, the right. Credible fear.
Do you have any documentation or you're just going to tell your story like you just told us and hope they believe you?
Yes, that's what I hear. And the first time you have to speak with the truth, right? And say everything, what is happening. But then after when you have the court, then you can prove, show all the proof that you have. Even if they ask for something, yes, I do. I have some papers with me that can show that why I'm running out from my country, right?
Do the cartels, when they do the extortion, do they ever give you any? Do they give you written warnings or threats, or they just come and talk to you?
No, warnings, threats. Yes,
so
I do.
You don't have anything showing that if you don't pay
yes,
them
I
X
do.
Amount.
Yes,
oh,
I do.
Do.
Yes, like the text message from WhatsApp and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah, and also they came to my business. They closed my business. I got proof of where I was located and also invoices and stuff like that. So many things that can prove that. That's another thing that we don't like to be here. We don't want to work over here because there is like two cartels over here that they control everything. For example, if I go out after 6 p.m., 7 p.m., I'm on risk that they can take me and start asking for money over there on USA if I have a family over there.
Now, will you describe this room for me and tell me who's here?
Okay, it is a small room. We are like 17 people here. And the room is about like probably, I don't know, 5, 4, 6, something like that with a small bathroom. We all use the bathroom. We don't have a toilet paper. Each of us have to see how we can deal with that, right? And as a mattress, we have like, I don't know, how do you call that? It's not like
a... yeah.
And we sleep all, and, I mean...
And there's so many kids, little kids. How they seem like they're doing okay, but...
Yeah, but most of them, they are sick right now. They have like a chicken pox and stuff. Mine doesn't have it, right? But I'm scared that the chicken grab it. I don't want that.
Tell me just what your hopes are for getting out of here and going to the United States.
My hopes?
Yeah.
Well, my hopes is that first of all, to be safe. That's the main thing that I want right now. See, my children is just like 3 years and a half, and I want the best future for her. I do, as I know USA, and I know Canada, I know how can I get a work and do something good for my family, right? And good for the country, too. I don't want to be any pain of nobody.
That was Nelson, a Salvadoran migrant waiting for his chance to apply for asylum in the U.S. For more information on the groups helping migrants on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBDY in Binghamton, New York, WXOJ in Florence, Massachusetts, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Moving toward justice, we are rising. For the first time in years, our forces are building again, cohering again. Marching again. In California, an all-star roster of activists, writers, and revolutionaries are coming together, marking a new period, a time of freedom. We're not saying nor suggesting that the movement has been quiescent. No, for it hasn't been. It has fought the good fight for life and health that has had national impact in prison systems literally across the country. I'm speaking here of the state's attempt to deny treatment for hepatitis C, an affliction that touches the lives of at least some 700,000 men and women in America's crowded prisons. Our people filled courtrooms and hit the streets to demand change and antiviral treatment for Hep C sufferers like me. They demanded change and made change that continues to radiate across America. A black doctor and internist from New York, Dr. Joseph Harris, took the stand and taught the world about Hep C. dispassionate, informed analysis of Hep C demolished the DOC's obstruction to treatment and opened the door to new precedents for Hep C sufferers. With the help of our lawyers, Brett Grote and Robert Boyle, established a new legal precedent that has helped thousands of imprisoned Hep C sufferers all across America live longer and healthier lives. Your support made it possible. Now, in California, we are continuing the march towards freedom. For soon, you will hear from some friends of our movement on the steps to come. People like Angela Davis, who herself years ago faced multiple death penalty charges until she was freed. Groundbreaking she is, an abolitionist and an anti-incarceration scholar and founder of Critical Resistance, a group that continues to fight against the prison industrial complex. Alice Walker, a literary lion and womanist, feminist activist and icon. Judith Ritter, Widener University Law School professor and author of several law review articles on criminal justice. Pam Africa, MOVE's Minister of Confrontation and founder of the international concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Jeff Mackler, editor of Socialist Action newspaper and radical activist who has worked lifelong on behalf of people's movements and struggles. From anti-imperial war and to the historic Lynn Stewart fight for freedom to our own. Professor Eula Taylor, African American Studies professor at UC Santa Barbara, who has taught prisoners at Lompoc. And Stephen Bingham. Remember the young dude who the cops said smuggled a weapon into George Jackson when he was in Soledad? That's the dude. He spent 13 years in France before he came back, went to trial, and was acquitted. Attorney, recently retired, Stephen Bingham. Voices of resistance, of rebellion, of new life, and of freedom. We are rising. The scent of freedom is in the air. This is our time to mobilize, to build, to create social change. This is the time, and we are that change. Won't you join us? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Trump, mad at the world. Donald Trump, from the first day he unleashed his venomous campaign for the U.S. presidency, has lashed out at people he considers beneath him. It began, as all now know, targeting Mexicans. It didn't take too long before others, usually people of color, felt the sting of his venom. From that day to this, the issue of immigration has been exploited to sow fear in millions. First came the wall, then the monstrous separation of children from their parents, which continues to this very day. Trump has tossed his cabinet members overboard unless they signed on to his malevolent plans. It is a gross power play meant to give succor and support to the paranoid right. It looks at the majority of the world's people and shouts, as Trump has recently done, "No more. It's full. We're full. Sorry." Sorry? Hardly.
Lady Liberty, standing gloriously in the New York harbor, should be sailed back to France from which she came. Or perhaps more fitting, it should be melted down into metal and molded into a new steel wall. Call it the Wall of Liberty. The plaque welcoming immigrants? Just throw that away. Toss it into the trash. It's no longer needed. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Is the current president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, complicit in the Rwandan and Congolese genocides? Why did the International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda suppress evidence of the Tutsi militia's involvement in the murders that triggered 100 days of bloodshed in the African country? Who was responsible for establishing the one-sided narrative of the 1994 genocide that persists to this day? How do Western political and business elites continue to benefit from the cover-up of the crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front? On a week in which Rwandans are mourning the victims of the 25-year-old Rwandan genocide, the Global Research News Hour radio program explores an alternative interpretation of events, one implicating the Tutsi-dominated forces of former RPF General Paul Kagame in the brutal killing of hundreds of thousands of people during one of the most gruesome and reviled acts of inhumanity in recent history. We will hear opinions from radio show host Phil Taylor, a former investigator for the International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda, and get a breakdown of the events of 25 years ago from Judy Reaver, a Canadian journalist who spent 20 years researching the Rwandan genocide and detailed her findings in a 2018 book. On this week's program, Rwandan Genocide Revisited, Impunity for War Criminals That Serve Western Interests. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 12, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The media blackout that has shrouded the true impact of NATO's intervention in Libya for the past 8 years helps enable the U.S. and its NATO partners to perpetrate additional proxy wars and political interventions elsewhere. As the U.S. openly pursues aggressive regime change in Venezuela and meddles in the internal politics of nations across Southeast Asia, the fruits of U.S. intervention in places like Libya should always be kept in mind. What is most alarming of all is considering that the U.S.-led intervention in Libya may not necessarily be a failure. It is only a failure if one believed the U.S. truly sought a better future for the nation. However, if the fruits of perpetual chaos and an equally perpetual pretext for the U.S. militarization of Africa were intentionally set out for from the beginning, then in many ways Libya was a resounding success. That comes from the article Battlefield Libya, Fruits of U.S.-NATO Regime Change by Tony Cartolucci, posted April 10th, originally published at New Eastern Outlook. So what should we make of the fall of Baghdad 16 years ago, or the broader invasion and destruction of Iraq, which by now has clearly turned out to be one of the most important events of the 21st century? One,
that greed for power often causes leaders of powerful countries to lie their citizens into waging wars against less powerful nations. And given the sophistry of modern weaponry, those wars are now costlier in terms of destroying human lives than ever. Two, this is especially true for democracies where, as Julian Assange explains, quote, wars are a result of lies, unquote. Lies such as Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, Gaddafi is providing Viagra to his soldiers to rape women, Assad is attacking unarmed Syrian civilians, etc., all of which have now been proven untrue. Third, had these lies been exposed early enough, there is a chance that all these wars could have been avoided and millions of lives spared. That comes from the article, The Fall of Baghdad 16 Years Ago, A Moment That Defines the Events Now Shaping Our World, by Iresh Omar Jamal, posted April 10th. Russia has herself constituted the status of nuclear superpower for decades, and there is consequently little doubt that NATO's march eastwards has become an existential threat to humanity. It is remarkable to witness the strong support that NATO retains from famous institutions and elite figures who are, as a result, actively encouraging a nuclear conflict. The New York Times on 14th of January 2019 outlined under a heading of New Concerns Over Russia that NATO is a, quote, military alliance among the United States, Europe, and Canada that has deterred Soviet and Russian aggression for 70 years, unquote. While the Ukraine and Georgia are, quote, two non-NATO members with aspirations to join the alliance, unquote. There is no mention in the New York Times analysis pertaining to NATO's rapid growth following Soviet disintegration and the grave danger to our world should the Ukraine and Georgia merge to the organization. Nor does the New York Times evaluation discuss NATO aggression directed at Afghanistan, Libya, etc. That comes from the article Elite and Media Support for NATO, Increasing Threat of War with Russia, by Shane Quinn, posted April 10th. To support the persecution of Assange in these circumstances is to support absolute state censorship of the internet. It is to support the claim that any journalist who receives and publishes official material which indicates U.S. government wrongdoing can be punished for its publication. Furthermore, this U.S. claim involves an astonishing boost to universal jurisdiction. Assange was nowhere near the USA when he published the documents, but nonetheless, U.S. courts are willing to claim jurisdiction. This is a threat to press and internet freedom everywhere. That comes from the article, Chelsea and Julian Are in Jail, History Trembles, by Craig Murray, posted April 12th, originally published on the author's blog site. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. April 7th marks the beginning of a week of mourning, marking the anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. At a solemn ceremony in Kigali, the country's capital city, Rwandan President Paul Kagame, in the company of foreign dignitaries, including Canada's Governor General, laid a wreath and lit a flame at the Kigali Genocide Memorial, which will burn for 100 days, corresponding with the duration of the infamous killing spree, which claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. The massacre had been triggered on April 6, 1994, 25 years ago this month, when an airplane carrying the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi was shot down over Kigali. The standard narrative holds that the Rwandan police and militia proceeded to kill Tutsi and moderate Hutu leaders who could have taken control in the ensuing power vacuum. Hutu civilians were recruited to arm themselves with blunt and edged weapons and attack, kill, and rape their Tutsi neighbors. The Tutsi-dominated Rwandan Patriotic Front opposed these genocidal forces and took control of Kigali by early July, ending the genocide. There is, however, a counter-narrative that holds that it was the forces of the RPF commander, Paul Kagame, now Rwandan president, who instigated the violence and were responsible for much of the bloodshed to the tune of hundreds of thousands of people. This counter-narrative and the evidence substantiating it is at the heart of this week's Global Research NewsHour radio program. We start our inquiry by deconstructing the official body that was tasked with investigating these crimes against humanity. The following interview was recorded on Thursday, April 11th. Well, joining us right now from Toronto is Phil Taylor. I'm very delighted to finally have him on my show. He's been, probably one of the few people, even in independent media, who's been really tackling some hard-hitting topics. Phil Taylor, in addition to his work as host and producer of The Taylor Report on CIUT 89.5 FM, he was a former private investigator for ICTR defense attorneys, and he's become a prominent critic of the court. And, of course, he has also been one of the, at one point, virtually alone in critiquing the Rwanda genocide narrative, a one-sided narrative. So I'd like to welcome you, Phil Taylor, to the Global Research News Hour.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, first of all, Phil, how did you get involved with the ICTR?
I was working in Toronto at the firm of Roach Schwartz, for Charles Roach specifically, and Charles Roach was a Pan-Africanist. He was very involved with issues to do with Africa and followed events there. So we were following the armed struggle that was going on inside Rwanda from 1990. October 1990 was when the RPF invaded Rwanda from Uganda. They were led by officers of the Ugandan army. Anyhow, we were aware of that. And when the terrible events of April 1994 occurred and the RPF prevailed in a armed conflict with the Rwandan army, it was announced there was going to be a tribunal, a United Nations established ad hoc tribunal. And Charles Roach and myself and others said it seemed unlikely that there would be very many lawyers willing to defend the people who had been described in such terrible terms by the mainstream media. We knew that the events there had not been accurately depicted in the New York Times, Washington Post, elsewhere. Charles and myself, Ramsey Clark and others, made sure to approach people accused and said if they wished to have counsel, there were people willing to step up and act in their defense. And as a result, I found myself going as an investigator. The first lawyer I worked for actually was Luc de Temmerman, a Belgian lawyer, and then Defend Dixon and others, that's how I got engaged with it.
Mm. Maybe could you tell me about a couple of anecdotes that really stuck out for you as you were pursuing this investigation?
If I heard you right, it's anecdotes, right?
Yes, anecdotes.
Yes. Well, what stands out to me is that in the opening address to the court, the prosecutor, Louise Arbour of Canada, said that this was going to be a standard of justice. It was going to really be a display of how wonderful Western values and whatnot could be brought to bear. This was going to be she very specifically said it's not going to be victor's justice. And that the other great mission was they were going to end the culture of impunity in Africa, which, looking back on that phrase now, you realize how insulting and absurd that is. There is no culture of impunity in Africa any more than there's a culture of impunity here, where people don't get charged who should be charged, as the public would know. It did turn out to be a victor's justice because no one from the RPF side, the Rwandan Patriotic Forces Army, was ever charged. And it so that stands out in my memory because it was, in that sense, false, completely false. And indeed, impunity was given to the present leadership of the government of Rwanda. It was, even though investigators working under Louise Arbour found that, in their opinion, Paul Kagame's personnel had assassinated two African presidents on April the 6th, 1994, triggering the bloody events that followed. That was a direct report to her. That was suppressed. There was never any prosecution, not just of any of his officers. There was no RPF person was ever charged. So it was victor's justice, and it was impunity for the present government. They created a story in which the present government, Paul Kagame, were basically the good guys, and anyone who opposed them were the bad guys. The only other, one other anecdote that stands out for me to show them how the philosophy of the court, Judge Kama, presiding over the court, found himself one day at a press conference because there had been an unexpected glitch in the beginnings of the court, and they had not been able to open the court when they had expected. And there was a lot of media from around the world had come there for the great grand opening of the first trial. And so they, in order to entertain the media, they decided to have a keep them occupied. Kama gave a little press conference. Anyway, he said, now the big fish have been captured. He meant by that that some well-known individuals who you and I would presume think should have the presumption of innocence were described by the man presiding over the court as big fish. So that's what I remember. Mm.
You touched on the Michael Horgan's UN investigation into the murders which triggered the genocides back in April 6th, and then Louise Arbour essentially obstructed it. What I mean has she have you been or have you ever had a chance to confront her about that, or you know why you know the rationale, especially coming from someone who, as you said, was claiming that there's not going to be victor's justice here.
Why that was suppressed?
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael Horgan, by the way, is a very conscientious Australian lawyer, outstanding man, and we've lost him, I'm sorry to say. I did interview him a couple times on my program. The world media pretty much ignored him. He got some attention in Australia. People should know the story of Michael. He was working with a man named Lyons, a FBI investigator, quite competent, outstanding individual, in my opinion. Anyhow, they made the report in which they said it was the evidence was, in their view, compelling that Kagame was behind the assassination of the two presidents. Well, they had to suppress it because they had another narrative, which was the Kagame narrative, which was that the Hutu so-called leadership of Rwanda were extremist fanatics and had killed their own president. And if you were to introduce that idea, even properly investigated and have it even talked about, then you were going to interrupt the established narrative. And, of course, they argued the social peace of Rwanda. They had he had secured through violence his authority. And if you were to say, well, there's actually some evidence that he might himself be compromised, obviously the whole thing would fall apart in a sense. And so in the name of maintaining peace and serenity in Rwanda, it was considered best not to mention that, these matters. I think that's the principal reason they did it and are continuing to, actually. Mm.
Luis Arbour was replaced by Carla Del Ponte, and she seemed to be dedicated to getting to the truth of the RPF's involvement. What insights do you have into the mechanisms at place that effectively sabotaged what she was trying to do?
Well, yes, I thank you for reminding me. Yes, Carla Del Ponte seems to have been cut from different cloth. She, I saw her quite a few times, and I was impressed when she seemed determined to sort of balance the ledger a bit, because she had all kinds of evidence. So after all, it was a war, and that produces war crimes. And you, they don't usually, war crimes don't just fall on one side of the fence. So she had ample evidence from her own investigations that of crimes committed by RPF personnel. So the impunity extended beyond Kagame himself to anyone functioning under him. She challenged that, and she was told she could not do that. The man, you know, the man who told her that she couldn't do it and told her not to do it, not to continue looking into or thinking about bringing charges against Paul Kagame, was Pierre Prosper, who had started off at the ICTR in Arusha as a prosecutor. He was an American prosecutor from Los Angeles. And then after he left the ICTR, he went on to bigger things, and he was given a special post. I used to call it the genocide ambassador for the United States. And so she found herself in a room with him. He's just an American representative. Discussing whether or not she's going to continue raising the possibility of RPF crimes. As a result, her stubbornness led to her removal, basically. She tells the story rather very well herself. And while I wasn't sympathetic with her methods in prosecuting, I was certainly... I think it's really important to note that she did buck the system at a certain point and say, look, you know, I'm supposed to be looking into crimes, and I can't do it to suit political interests, particularly of the Americans. Everybody should ask, why would the Americans get so involved in all this? Why is it so? Why isn't it the UN? Why is she talking to this U.S. ambassador of genocide or whatever it was?
What was in the ICTR itself and the structure or the limitations that may have been inherent to that that process? Would you say it comes down to certain personalities, or was there some certain things that limited its the scope of this investigation? I mean, if it's favoring a certain narrative, then it dares not tread in the area of RPF involvement, given the role of Kagame in actually being president of Rwanda. So, what are your thoughts about some of those structural constraints?
I think the ICTR, from those who designed it, was there to aid and abet Kagame's consolidation of power. I believe that what was taking place was that when he got power through sheer brutal force, took over, he had very powerful allies, but most of them in the West. I don't think he was very... African leaders were watching him closely, and they had a rough idea who he was and were not enamored of him. I think that they had a problem. When they wanted to make the case that there'd been a planned genocide, they wanted to criminalize anyone opposed to them. So they, but had Kagame been left to him and his resources, the African states around him, if he said, you have a criminal there, I want you to turn him over to me, they would ask him, show me the evidence. Show our country the evidence. We're sovereign states, and we know a little bit about this. And he wouldn't have gotten cooperation. As a matter of fact, there were problems. Several states had turned him down already because you can't just automatically say, arrest somebody and bring him. But if the United Nations ICTR gets involved, they say, well, we're not, you see, we're above the battle. This isn't victor's justice. We're simply trying to establish, you know, good guys, bad guys. And therefore, you should turn them over to us. Which that was harder. It would be more difficult for a state to say to the United Nations, well, no, no, we're not going to cooperate with you. So they said, sure, well, okay, we'll cooperate with you. And so in that sense, UN was doing the bidding and working, as they said, very tightly with the Kagame government. So I think they were helping him consolidate his power. And one of the things they obviously agreed to was that he could not be compromised. They had to make sure they protected him. So he had impunity, and he has impunity to this day.
For years, you've been virtually a lone voice, at least in the English language, in challenging the official assumptions around the Rwandan genocide. What kind of pushback have you received?
Now we are seeing, which would inevitably happen, is that the population, which of course lived the experience and they have their own ideas and knowledge of the matters, they have been generating new spokesperson, people who want to see the truth told properly and in a forum and where people are not criminalized for having opinions and permitted to describe things act more accurately than has been before. Now, there's Victoire Ingabire, who is in prison, not in prison, well, she's under, basically I'd call it house arrest in Rwanda. She did 7 years in prison for simply stating in a reasonable way that the narrative about the events has been lacking, putting it mildly. There's a second woman, of course, Diana Wigara. She is, I like the fact that Victoire is Hutu, Diana is Tutsi, but they agree on something. And that is that you have a narrow, militarized state that is heavily supported by Britain, United States, and certainly now France, Belgium, which is not, that permits no breathing space or opportunity to bring to fruition the original concept of a multi-party system and the people's right to have a actual vote and participate. And of course, Kagame himself has invaded the Congo twice. He's had threatened his neighbor Burundi. He's harbored in Rwanda armed elements that attacked Burundi. He's threatened the prime minister of Tanzania in a nasty way. He's assassinated people in South Africa, who used to work for him, and in Kenya, the famous Senda Shonga was murdered in Kenya. Kagame virtually admitted it the other day that it was a decision of the state of Rwanda. So there is unhappiness with the way he conducts himself and the question about why he enjoys such strong support in Ottawa and Washington. I think there's pushback. I mean, there is. Eventually, as I say, the truth will out. And also, the Rwandan people are not going to continue to live under a narrow, militarized regime.
I was curious, though, about you personally, if you've gotten pressure from anybody, whether it's outside figures or from within your radio station or anywhere else, you know, if you were.
Oh, yeah. Yes, there have been people who tried to prevent my even discussing this, actually, not the station. The station is a very courageous and protector of open airways, and they we should be very proud of alternative radio in North America. There's not a lot of it, but yes, some prominent individuals have said I should not be allowed to interview people. I interview terrible people like the former prime minister of Rwanda, Faustin Togiri Mungu, and others. I talked to Colonel Marshall of Belgium, who was himself right on the scene in April 1994, a wonderful man. He suffers from honesty and therefore gets in trouble too.
And I've talked to the families of assassinated people. To me, that is a responsibility, a duty I have from my experience. I'm supposed to say what I know, what I've seen. Yeah, I've had some, but I guess they call it pressure. I don't mind it at all.
Phil Taylor, it's been a pleasure having you on our show. Thank you for sharing your insights with our listening audience.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Phil Taylor. He is the host of the Taylor Report on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and a former private investigator for ICTR. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Finalist for the Hilary Weston Writers' Trust Prize, Canadian journalist Judy Reaver spent 20 years investigating the crimes committed during the Rwandan genocide. In her 2018 book, In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, Reaver argues that Paul Kagame and the RPF forces he commanded were culpable in instigating the violence against hundreds of thousands in 1994 and then continuing the violence in Congo. The Global Research News Hour reached out to Judy recently for an interview. We commenced the interview with her recollection of how this story got hold of her and continue to hold her attention to this day. She explained that it started with her 1997 encounter with refugees in what was then Zaire, now Congo. She was a journalist accompanied by aid workers covering the humanitarian situation. Here she explains what she learned that shaped her impressions of what actually happened in 1994 Rwanda.
Essentially, what the Hutu refugees told me was that the RPF had killed their families during the genocide. And because I had seen myself and had listened to so many accounts from Hutus in the jungle of how they'd been chased, hunted down, and their family members had been killed, I believed what they said. So it was diametrically opposed to the story that we had read in newspapers and that I had absorbed myself. So this took a while to, these ideas and all this testimony I collected took a while to kind of sift and shake down. But I believed it, and it was deeply troubling to me. I just didn't understand to what extent the RPF killed. But there were a few reasons after that trip, which was life-changing, that I kept on the story. It was a puzzle to me that I labored over for two decades. I'd get a piece of it, and I couldn't see the entire picture. I didn't see the entire picture in 97. I saw the Congolese portion, but I saw only just a part of what might have happened in Rwanda. But it bothered me so much existentially that I kept having to go back. So that... That's essentially how it began.
Mm. Now, just to maybe so our listeners can get a little bit more clarity of what the allegations are here, we know that the RPF, based in Uganda, just north of Rwanda, that this RPF group, they were dominated by Tutsis, exiled from Rwanda. Talk about the crimes, the actual crimes that you know, your research has led you to believe were committed by this group as they descended into Rwanda.
Well, there are the crimes of the invasion war that started in 1990. And you're right, the founders of the RPF, the principal founders, were raised in Uganda. These are Rwandan people who were raised in refugee camps, essentially in Uganda, after the anti-Tutsi pogroms in the late 50s and early 60s. And so their story comes from a refugee experience, and there was a lot of bitterness and anger among this group. And so when they tried to reclaim their place, reclaim power, they invaded in 1990 and carried out a scorched earth campaign in northern Rwanda, essentially, and brought the country to the knife's edge by 1994. So that's the initial story. Now, my book actually deals more with the fact that the RPF planned and carried out the assassination of Habyarimana, which was the act that triggered the genocide. And then the research that I've accumulated over the years from RPF deserters and defectors and Hutu victims shows that the RPF engaged in a very well-orchestrated campaign of ethnic cleansing and genocide against Hutus in all the zones that they quickly seized, from the north where they were controlling at the very beginning of the genocide, down the eastern side, then up from the south to the middle of the country, and then to the west, to the north. They cleared out Hutus, they targeted Hutu community leaders, and then they went after peasants in behind the military front, and they did this in a very organized way, and they concealed a lot of their crimes in part because of propaganda, and they portrayed themselves as moral victors, and the international community believed them, but also because they hid a lot of the evidence, and a lot of people were killed and burned.
The RPF moved very swiftly after the assassination. I think that seems to be one of the significant indicators, no?
Yes, they did. They seized areas quite quickly. And, I mean, to make sure that listeners understand, Tutsis were being targeted in all the Hutu-controlled areas before the RPF arrived in those areas. So we have Tutsis being rounded up and killed in Kigali. We have them killed in a number of areas throughout the country before the RPF arrived. But what my book deals with is the dynamic of what was happening in RPF zones to Hutus principally. And my book reveals paradoxically, and this is the shocking aspect for a lot of listeners, that the RPF infiltrated Hutu militias, and Hutu militias were the dominant forces that killed most Tutsis in Rwanda during the Rwandan genocide. My book gives evidence that shows the RPF infiltrated those Hutu militias with their commandos and amplified the genocide against Tutsis. So people will say, why would they do that? And I've tried to explain in the book, and I try to explain to people who interview me, that they did that in order to use interior Tutsis who had always stayed in Rwanda under the Habyarimana regime, and even before. They used those Tutsis as fodder. They used them because they wanted the body count to soar. They wanted a moral victory, and they wanted to make sure that the Hutu militias and the enemy forces were as demonized as possible.
You also mention in the book these just pointing to the level of sophistication, these civilian cadres that were invoked in these RPF-dominated areas. Can you maybe help, and you've spoken to people who are active with those civilian cadres. Can you maybe help share with our listeners, what you heard that inform about these cadres that informed your understanding of how and why people participated in the killings of former neighbors and friends?
Well, the our understanding of the genocide is that this was a popular genocide committed by Hutus against Tutsi civilians. Okay, popular meaning that Hutu civilians picked up machetes and killed their neighbors. Okay, there is a substantial amount of evidence and some very good evidence, and through all the trial proceedings and all the testimonies, and even by researchers who know what they're doing, shows probably 8 to 10% of the Hutu population killed their neighbors. What my book points out as well is that Tutsi civilians who became civilian cadres for the RPF and for and worked hand in hand with the RPF's army, the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Army, to do similar things. So a lot of these people were recruited in the years before the genocide, and they were recruited rapidly during the genocide. These are Tutsi civilians, and who were trained or sometimes just recruited very quickly. So what would they do? They would have, in the same way Hutu civilians participated in the genocide against Tutsis, they would have singled out Hutu neighbors and identified them for the Rwandan Patriotic Front in every zone that the RPF seized. And so they facilitated the massacres, and in many instances, they directly participated in the massacres. And these civilian cadres, who were called something, they were called Abakada, are now called Intore in today's Rwanda. And this is equivalent to a militia. So Kagame has long had his own militia. There was what we all know as the Hutu Interahamwe militia that operated against Tutsis during the genocide. Well, Kagame had his own militia as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've, of course, as I mentioned, you've based your understanding on a number of interviews that you've conducted with different people who are involved in these cadres, defectors. You mentioned in particular one individual, Teogjin Marwanshialka.
Yes.
I know that's been a point of contention in some of the criticisms, critiques I've heard, like, for example, Gerald Kaplan. Mm-hmm. What can you say to those people who might have some skepticism about the credibility of the sources and that you're not just being drawn down the garden path? Can you speak to that?
Well, a number of people like Gerald Kaplan have suggested early on, not understanding my work, that, I'm relying on, always this pejorative term, Hutu genocidaire, a very blanket statement. And to be honest, the level of my sources, as I mentioned, I started off interviewing Hutu victims in Congo, then I expanded that to refugees worldwide in Europe and from Africa, other areas, other countries in Africa, and here in Canada and the United States. Then I started accessing former RPF guys, so soldiers and officers, pardon me, like Teogjin Marwanshialka. So I interviewed so many of them, and so many of their stories coalesced. Many of these guys had enormous courage, and they fled in the early years, in about 2000, 2001, as soon as they could. Some of them fled later, but the large majority of my sources are former RPF guys who are not affiliated with any political opposition group. Some of them are, of course, but there's just such a pattern of atrocities that they describe, which then bubbles up in the other layer of sources that I have, which is UN leaked documents and interviews with officials. So I think Gerald Kaplan and a few other people who criticize my work are quite disingenuous, because there's just so many different sources I've used. Many of them actually have been bold enough to give me their name, and they speak on the record. Not all of them, of course. Most of them, except in particular people who are still in Africa, who could be killed any day by Kagame and his agents, they can be named. And, I think everyone understands how anyone who's researched this understands how Kagame and his regime operate beyond borders. They kill dissidents. They kill people who speak out against them. And so the suggestion that I should have, you know, my work is undermined by using anonymous sources is really quite extraordinary to me, especially when the Bible of the Rwandan genocide, with which we believe, you know, everyone believes, Human Rights Watch's account of the genocide, which is Leave None to Tell the Story, I would say a majority or, you know, a good part of their sources are anonymous as well.
Maybe elaborate a little bit more on the kinds of threats that have been faced. I mean, you mentioned a little bit about some of the people who were, you know, coming forward, but, you know, first of all, I wanted to give you a chance to speak to some of the threats that you yourself have personally had to confront.
Well, I mean, I had from the get-go, I had very scary experiences in Congo trying to do my job as a journalist. I filed reports in 1997, one that got a lot of attention on CBC radio about Rwandan soldiers massacring Hutus in Bandaka. I found myself in a villa in Kisangani on the Congo River, and I was, you know, the villa was being fired upon. My window was being fired at by unknown military forces. Over the years, as I've intensified, I took this up more actively and full-time. I've been chased. I've been threatened. My family has been threatened. I've had car problems that have made me wonder whether or not people here in Montreal are fiddling with my tires. I have been protected by Belgian state security while doing interviews in Belgium in 2014. More recently, a few weeks ago, I was in Texas and had to be protected there by police, by a SWAT team at a conference where I spoke. It's really extraordinary. But, you know, I'm still here to talk about these issues, but I just want to say one thing about the threats that are leveled against it. I mean, what I'm experiencing is nothing compared to what the Congolese and Rwandan whistleblowers and journalists and human rights activists and others who have tried to sound the alarm. These people have attempted to expose Kagame and his regime and the crimes they've committed. They've, in some cases, done it publicly or privately to UN tribunals or in other jurisdictions, and they've paid with their life. And others have been jailed, or they've disappeared, or they've been accused of crimes for speaking out. Nobody has protected them. The international community decided instead to protect Kagame, and I would say we're still living in that universe. This is still going on.
Now, we have, you mentioned in the book, a London-based NGO which created the narrative, or you claim created this narrative about the genocide as a Hutu-instigated bloodbath, you know, exclusively. Can you supply us with full disclosure about that NGO and connections that may have compromised its objectivity with regard to Rwanda?
Well, the NGO I talk about in the book, and there's been some very good research on this NGO. It's called African Rights. The research that I'm referring to has been done by a guy at Notre Dame University named Luc Redams. But I've done my own research, and he's done the bulk of it. And so this NGO is called African Rights. It was run by Rakia Omar and Alex DeWall. And within weeks of the genocide ending, they wrote a huge compendium that included an instant charge sheet naming most of the Hutu perpetrators and claiming that the RPF stopped the genocide and they were the moral victors. So it also claimed that the former Hutu government, conspired for years in advance to commit genocide against Tutsis, And it turned out that this narrative that they sold in this book, Death, Despair, and Defiance, was created hand-in-hand with the RPF and its civilian cadres. So the book, which was often called DD&D, had a big impact in the early years on the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, that's the UN Tribunal. And even organizations like Human Rights Watch picked up a lot of that narrative and cited African rights work dozens and dozens of times in its opus, leading them to tell the story. So we have journalists and academics absorbing this official narrative of light forces against dark forces, good guys against bad guys, and how, as well, all those terrible Hutus who fled to Zaire had committed, you know, a bulk of them had committed genocide. It was sweeping. It was false. These, you know, Hutus as a group were demonized and gaslighted. And so more work has to be done in exposing these people. I mean, it turned out that Maki Omar, in the later years, we got evidence that she was receiving money from the RPF. Alex DeWall, who was part of African Rights in the early years but left, he, in an interview, bragged about creating the conspiracy theory that suggested that the Hutu government has planned for years and years to commit genocide. And then, you know, recently, within the last few years, he said he made that up, and he was wrong.
How do you make sense of journalists and human rights activists? I mean, this narrative aside, I mean, you're supposed to double check and corroborate and whatnot. How do you make sense of the way those sorts of actors fail to account for the evidence you and others have brought forward of the RPF's killing spree, which was comparable to that conducted by the Hutu extremists?
Well, the official narrative it's been around for, you know, a quarter of a century now, and it's so compelling, and people believe it. So it's very hard to dismantle. My book came out last year. I mean, there have been so many... A lot of the evidence about RPF committing human rights violations and having killed during the genocide and after, a lot of that evidence has been there. I just think the scope and scale of it has not been revealed. And, you know, my book deals with the Directorate of Military Intelligence, and my book exposes through official documents, confidential documents of the United Nations, a lot of things that maybe people refuse to look at. But I think the problem is, yeah, how do we deal with the number of journalists who were covering the genocide and who were there at the time? How do we change their minds that they didn't see what was going on, or they refused to look at what was going on? That's a very good question. I think it's going to take years of before people actually completely begin to grasp some of this stuff. I think we need to read more about it. I suggest people read my book, but I think it would be an even better idea for people to listen to the people who have fled, for governments to listen to the people who have fled. I don't think we're going to understand the level of criminality of the Rwandan Patriotic Front and Kagame historically and today until he leaves power, because he has a very tight hold over people there, over their lives. It's a police state that he operates. And with his embassies and with all of his cadres and agents abroad, people are very afraid to reveal some of this stuff,
yeah,
because they risk their lives. So it's going to take many, many years.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book that Rwanda isn't a country anymore. It's a basically a powerful system of control. Let me just read from a quote from the book from you. It says, "My world changed forever when I discovered the degree to which Western officials acquiesced to and at times actively assisted a regime that butchered women and children in the forests I've visited. Even now, when politicians in the West speak about the democratic values they hold dear, my heart turns cold." Could you maybe give us a specific example of that active assistance that you refer to?
Well, I'm referring to what I saw in Congo there, and my world view shattered in 1997, and I grew up, I think, because where I was, I arrived, and just a few days after a major massacre had been committed by the RPF in a place called Bandaka, where I went to, but also a few weeks before I arrived, the south of the Congo River, south of Kisangani, all these refugees in the tens of thousands had been massacred by the RPF in under triple layer canopy in the forest. And while that was going on in April 1997, there were brokerage houses and Western mining companies and Western officials, some of whom were from the U.S. government, who were doing business deals, and they had been flying into rebel-held zones. So at the same time that these Hutu refugees were being massacred in the jungle, in the Zairean jungle, there were Western companies and their Western political backers who were striking deals, and they were those deals were providing money to the rebel forces, Kagame's rebel forces, who were unseating Mobutu. And so it became clear to me that these refugees and Congolese victims were being sacrificed for realpolitik and for these business deals. And it was, quite frankly, it was too much for me to believe and absorb, but it was true, and I was seeing it. So it was devastating.
Okay. And just quickly, just beyond correcting the historical record, what do you see are the consequences in the here and now for allowing the official story of the Rwandan genocide to stand unchallenged?
This whole story is important because there's a feedback loop of human rights violations. So, I mean, if you look at the ICTR, UN Tribunal, they were not interested in accountability or reconciliation. They were interested in politics. And I think you can unfortunately see, and this goes to my point earlier, is that, you know, Kagame has been useful to the West because he's opened up a corridor for the exploitation of minerals. The West has this quid pro quo relationship with Kagame. We know he's committed colossal crimes, but he's our man in Central Africa. Why is Central Africa important to us? Because it's where the world economy starts, with the copper, cobalt, tungsten, tin, and coltan. They're essential for all the things that we use, the electronics, the batteries, the aeronautics. So these networks of trade have been opened up. And also Kagame provides the peacekeepers for the United Nations and that helps the U.S. in their war against terror. But it's extraordinary, but we're allowing this cycle of violence continue. So I think that's the legacy. That's why it's important. And these are the risks going forward with our current genocide narrative going unchallenged.
Judy Reber, I really want to thank you for sharing your perspectives with our listening audience. And thank you so much for the amount of time and effort you put into putting together this very important book.
Thanks for your interest.
We've been speaking with Canadian journalist Judy Reaver, who is the author of In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. She joined us from Montreal.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.